Coming up on Boston Public Radio, one of my true guilty pleasures is going through the Weston tolls, flying by E-ZPass resistors as they sit in endless traffic. The state just launched an outreach program to these transponder-averse people. We'll ask why some of you sign up and why many of you do not. Then Callie Crossley joins us on the casino conundrum, primary day holdouts, and beautiful new lights in the city.
Malcolm Rogers is leaving the Museum of Fine Arts after 20 years at the helm. He'll join us on his revolutionary tenure there. Emily Rooney on Joan Rivers, dead at 81. Corrupt politicians falling like dominoes, and of course, her spectacular list of observations and complaints. And our Friday news quiz features two Harvard students who've invented, get this, cake in a can. All that coming up on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to WGBH, Boston Public Radio, 89.7.
Hey there.
Hello, Jim.
How are you?
You don't need the weather report. We just have one.
I'm not going to give it. Okay. I heard it. Okay. Right. Now, for all of you commuters out there or travelers who don't have an E-ZPass, be forewarned. We've read the Massachusetts Department of Transportation is actively campaigning to get you to sign up now that, I assume you know, all electronic tolling has been implemented on the Tobin Bridge. According to the Mass.dot press release, here's what it said, quote, the E-ZPass street team will be enrolling new customers in the E-ZPass throughout the month of September. So what we want to know is this, what is stopping the 27% of you who drive our roads from joining E-ZPass? Why would you not want to zip through a lane? What pleasure is there to be derived from, I don't know, fumbling with your wallet, leaning out the car window after you've been in line for 15 minutes to hand a crumpled bill to the toll taker? Our number is 877-301-8970. This is confused. I mentioned at the top a couple of minutes ago, I'm coming back from Western Massachusetts, having left my kid in Western Mass at school. I think it was on Monday, on Labor Day. The line for the cash payments is maybe a half a mile, three quarters of a mile. I don't even have to hit the brake to get through the E-ZPass lane. I do not understand this at all. 877-301-8970.
They're worried about Big Brother spying on them. That's the big reason people gave in this Globe story. Government surveillance. They're worried about erroneous fees charged automatically to their credit cards. They feel bad for the toll takers. I mean, this is unusual, I think, because a lot of us have been making fun of the toll takers for years.
You in particular, yes.
Well, they have. What is the average salary? Like 70 grand?
I don't know what it is.
It's pretty good money.
Well, they're eventually all going to be gone.
Yeah, right? I know. Okay. But the great pensions. Well, they're going to be not going to be gone. They're going to be moved into different,
okay, so
different kind of jobs. The reason I made fun of the toll takers is because they were always being attacked by the cash drawers.
I've read your columns, Margaret. I've read them.
Well, they weren't my columns, actually. They were one of my colleagues.
Oh, Howie's column.
Yeah,
we'll write
Howie
those. That's right.
Columns, where somehow they'd open the cash drawer, and the cash drawer was always falling on their foot. And they'd be out on disability for like 3 years collecting their salary. Anyway, the other big thing is, apparently, and I did not know this, Jim, this is outrageous.
What's that?
That there have been accusations of toll transactions being handed over in civil cases, such as divorce proceedings, so that the aggrieved spouse can find out where her husband or his wife really was when she said she was overtaking care of her sick mother.
Well, you know, the reason I can relate to that surveillance argument, as you know, I'm upset that there are too many cameras and those sort of things.
That's right.
It's because if you don't have an E-ZPass, then don't worry, government has no idea where you are. I mean, are these people kidding? Do they have a credit card? Do they make a cell phone call? I mean, it's almost like these people, it's 27% of the population in Massachusetts, which is not a small number. It's like those people that lock themselves in, what, in New Hampshire, that dentist and her husband or whatever it was.
The people with the guns.
The resistors, the non-taxpayer. I mean, really, I don't understand this.
Well, there's other reasons. There's this one woman in the story who says that she the toll taking has been kind of a dating service for her. She dated a toll taker. I guess it didn't end in a marriage, and occasionally she would bring them coffee.
Okay, so what are you saying?
You think coffee?
Do you think one out of four drivers in Massachusetts are dating toll takers? I mean, is that what your explanation is for 26.6%?
The government isn't following them around. We have no idea what they're doing. One good thing, one good point on this, because I've had a transponder for years, ever since I went through the tolls without a transponder.
And they took your picture.
And they sent me a picture
of
my license plate and a $50 ticket, or maybe it was a $100 ticket. And of course, you can get them for free. You can drive up to one of those transponder places and just get them.
Yeah, they're free. They didn't used to be free. free at the beginning of the program.
They're not. But there is one good thing that I like. That if you're driving at not 2 o'clock in the morning and you're feeling kind of lonesome, you know, you could drive through the toll and chat up.
You're joking, I hope.
Well, I don't do it. I've got a transponder. But that is one point that people do. They like the human interaction.
Do you think these people who are –
the
Globe
hours.
Calls them conscientious objectors. I love the expression. Do you think if we were able to total up the amount of time these resistors spend waiting to get through a toll booth to pay mm-hmm. in a year – do you think that would not convince them that maybe is a more powerful motivation than your concern that Rich Davey, the Secretary of Transportation, is following your every move?
Oh, he's a suspicious character, Rich Davey. Who knows what he's doing in his off hours? I'm only kidding, of course. But I think they view it as kind of knuckling under to the man. And we just don't want to – we're holding out.
I'm curious to hear, when people call us and say they're part of the 27%, do you not have a credit card? Do you not have a cell phone? Do you not file taxes? I mean, what do you do to ensure – and by the way, I share a lot of these concerns, but I live in the real world. And the real world, which suggests that a transponder is not just an option anymore. It's a necessity unless you want to waste your life standing in line. 877-301-8970 is the number, 877-301-8970. Let's start in Bridgewater with Lauren. Hey, Lauren, how are you?
Doing fine, thank you. How are you?
We're excellent. Thank you for the call.
So, do you have a transponder or not?
No.
Why is that, Lauren?
I don't travel the roads enough to need one.
Oh.
I'm very, very infrequently in a toll, but honestly, if I was, I probably would stick with paying cash.
Now, why is that, Lauren? You're the person we're looking to talk to. Why is that?
Well, it has nothing to do with Big Brother and all that. It has to do with the criminals stealing all the credit card numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I lose sleep over the ideas of my identity being stolen.
Well, it's a serious problem. Do you go to Home Depot or Target, or you boycott those too?
Oh, I carry an awful lot of cash on me.
Oh.
I go to the bank, I withdraw cash, and I pay for everything in cash.
Oh, well, that at least that's consistent. I hear that. And if you're an infrequent user, I guess it makes sense. Last thing, though, when
that's
you are using
– in the email, too.
What, infrequent?
People that don't drive very much.
When you do use the highways, though, the tolled highways, and you're in line for 12 minutes while I'm zipping by, how does that feel?
Well, it's a two-edged sword. I see you zip by, and I think, man, that would be nice to be me. But then I think about the other option, and I feel comfortable.
You're a thoughtful soul. Hey, Lauren, thank you for the call. We really appreciate it.
You know, there is another upside to having the transponder because, of course, the Easy Pass works from here to Florida.
Yeah,
so,
it's huge.
So if you are driving, and I used to drive all the time to Philadelphia, you can drive all the way from here to Philadelphia on all these turnpikes with your Easy Pass. It's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, but the only reason we used to go to Florida was to escape surveillance. And now it turns out if you use the Easy Pass all the way to 877-301-8970.
Do you think mafiosos are using the Easy Pass, Jim? What do you think?
You know, incidentally, yeah, this thing we mentioned a minute ago, this campaign led by the Department of Transportation, they're serious about this. They've got a schedule. If you go on their website, tomorrow, for example, they're at Calhoun's 10 to 4 on Route 1 North. Wednesday, they're on Blackstone Street at the RMV office in Boston. Next Saturday, you know where they're going to be, Marjorie? 10 to 4 next Saturday? This is pretty great.
Where are they going to be?
Market Basket Chelsea. How great is that?
Now, here's an interesting email. This is from Jack.
Mm-hmm.
He says he really uses the pike and the bridges that I oppose making it easy for the Commonwealth to collect taxes. We were promised the tolls would be taken down. We were hoodwinked into the big dig. The transponders make it easier to keep taking our money.
Well, can I tell you, what's the name of that person?
Jack.
Well, hey, Jack, let me just say, as someone who just drove to Western Mass to leave my kid off, there's nothing I like more than taking 7 hours to drive to Springfield. I mean, and again, if you want to do that and you're a resistor and you're a pro, I respect it.
Yeah.
But the inconvenience level is just, it's epic.
Here's another one. Mary Ellen's husband.
Go ahead, what'd
very
you say?
Worried about being tracked.
Okay.
Jim. He wants to slither around undetected.
Okay, fine. 877-301-8970.
Greg from Norwood. What do you think about transponders, Greg?
Hey there.
I just love it. Let's all trust the government, Jim. They do such a great job on everything. Have you driven Route 3 lately?
Terrible.
I have, yes.
Terrible.
Well, maybe that's because we don't have the coal there. Where were these tolls going to come down anyway?
Never.
Seriously.
Never.
It's
never.
Ridiculous.
Well, first of all,
$14. It costs me $14 to go round trip via the train into Boston. So I have to now take the bike. But then I have to trust them because, remember, Obamacare is psyched on hack, what, yesterday? So what are you talking about?
Okay, so the assumption is you do not have a transponder, Greg. Is that the bottom line here?
You got it.
Okay,
Greg,
thank
that was
you.
A great call. That was he is fine a passionate. Call, he's a passionate man. You know, one of these people in this Globestrike talked about getting mistakes on her bill too.
Yeah, that may
and then it took forever to get the everything straightened out. She's calling and she's on hold.
Well, then
and
that person,
one,
I assume, if he is it a woman.
Yes.
So I assume that she doesn't have any credit cards because I assume you make get mistakes in your bills there too. Well, you know what you do? You look at your bill, and if there's a mistake, you call the place. And you say there's a mistake, and they'll take a charge off the thing.
Yeah, but this
I check my bills.
It takes hours. I've been.
It takes a lot less time than driving through.
Comcast to fix my email now for 3 days. I'm still waiting for my phone call. I haven't gotten it. My email's not working.
I work for Comcast.
I know you do that. Can you take care of me? I appreciate that.
All under control.
Okay, Christine.
I'll talk to my people.
Thank you, Christine from Reading. What do you think about transponders?
Hi, Christine.
Well, I personally have one, and I like it, but I held out for a long time because I only use it like twice a year, and you have to prepay. So it kind of irks me that I have to prepay, I don't know, if it's $20, and I'm only using, you know, $3 a year.
No, Christine, I have to say, I wish we had Rich Davey here, who we invited, the Secretary of Transportation, but he's unavailable. I thought that was one of the options. For example, my Easy Pass is on my credit card. I don't prepay anything. After I've used, I think when it hits $30 or something like that, they take it off your as a debit or a credit transaction. Is that not what you do?
Mine, once it hits a certain amount, it reloads like $20 at a time.
Uh huh. So what's the concern again?
Well, you know, it's just I'm basically loaning the government my money.
Oh, you mean you have to do upfront money? Is that what you're
That's
saying?
That's a good point. Right. That's
right.
A good point.
Well, I wish, again, we'll try to get the answer to that. I don't do that. I get billed after the fact, and I thought that as long as you give them a credit card,
well,
I thought
you
could
have,
do that.
You have to have the money in your account. Don't you have to go through and they
bill
say
you.
Low balance?
Yeah.
And that's because there's not enough money in your account to cover the cost, and then you hope it goes back in.
We hear you, Christine. Thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Here's a good point.
What's
this
that?
Is from Scott. He says, I love being tracked because as the senior moments become more frequent, I'm bound to get lost, and the only way they'll find me is the tracking.
So you have a transponder. You don't know where you are. You call the Val Patrick's office. You say, excuse me, this is John Doe from Quincy. Where am I at this particular 877? Yeah, by the way, I hope you know that every single caller so far, without one exception, either doesn't have a transponder or is not terribly happy about the fact that they do have a transponder.
Yeah, speaking of getting lost, I have to tell my favorite elderly driver story.
Sure.
If I may, I've told it a million times before, but why not one more time?
Is this the sand trap? You told us last week, didn't you?
Did I tell
it? Tell it again.
I'll tell it again. There was this elderly driver.
We should say it's courtesy of State Senator Brian Joyce.
Brian Joyce, who was crusading to have elderly drivers take a driver's test, which they should. He was absolutely right about that. Anyway, there was this great story about this guy that calls the cops. Where is he down
Plymouth,
in Plymouth or something? He calls the cops, 911, and he says, please come get me. I'm stuck in a snowdrift. And the cops are looking at each other saying, it's 85 degrees outside. What's he talking about? Stuck in a snowdrift. So they go down to rescue the guy. It turns out he's in a sand trap on some golf course in Plymouth.
What's
the
that poor
do
with
guy.
Transponders exactly?
Nothing. Well, it's Scott. The
it
saying is he gets going to get lost and he's old and he's right.
That is.
You have to get those buttons that they advertise in your station all the time. The fall and I can't get up button.
Yeah. Louisiana. Okay. It's one of the commercials. That's correct.
Okay.
Sells quite well, actually.
That's the next step, Jim. Shauna from Cambridge, what do you think?
Hello, Shauna.
Hi. Thanks for talking about this, because this is something that I get made fun of all the time by my boyfriend, my family, because I don't have one.
Mm-hmm.
And I drive all the time for work. And just I went to college in Philadelphia, grew up in Boston, did the drive from Philly to Boston a couple times a year. I never gave in. I don't think that the majority of people are afraid of being tracked. I just really find that hard. I think probably
are just Shauna, I really want to hear this. We're going to put you on hold. We'll take one call. Do not go away. Hopefully you'll be in a better cell area, and we'll come right back to you, I promise. Let's do Ted in Worcester. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hello there, Ted.
Hi there. I'm actually calling from the Pike. I'm here every day.
Great.
And I personally have a transponder just because of the convenience factor, but I have friends who refuse to get one because they like to support the jobs of the toll takers.
Yep.
And the fewer people that have transponders, the more toll takers you need. It's kind of a job support action on their part.
You know, we're getting a lot of emails about that. People are saying Pam just emailed and said she doesn't use the automatic takeout, the automatic checkout at CVS, or she doesn't do. She likes.
Actually, I don't do it at the grocery store for that reason. That's a good point.
To keep the cashiers with their jobs, but they're not going to lose their jobs. They're going to get transferred. They have a very powerful union, the toll takers.
Hey, Ted, let me ask you a mechanical question. I should know the answer to. If you have a transponder. And there's not a line, and you want to do what you or your friend wants to do, support the toll takers. If you drive through a cash-only lane with a transponder, you don't get charged twice, do you?
I'm pretty certain I would not.
Well, actually, that's not a decent, bad compromise. I understand that. Ted, thank you for the call. You mentioned that. You said that that's the motivation of some people, is they're concerned about the workforce.
Yeah, well, that's very...
None of them are... Are they getting laid off, or any of them getting laid off?
I'm 99% sure. I read that they were going to be trained to do other jobs unless they're attacked by their cash drawers between now.
In which case, they'll go on disability.
Oh, that was the other big thing. They had carpal tunnel syndrome for making the change. That was another big problem.
Can I ask you something? How would you like to do that job? In a confined little box.
I would not.
24 hours.
I would not.
8 hours a day being abused by, you know, some of the stories. If you read some of the stories about these toll takers about whom you were making fun, people throw change at them because they're angry on the road.
Yep.
People curse at them. I mean, it's almost like being, I know the term of art, not PC these days. Ticket givers are not whatever they called.
Ticket givers?
Well, people give tickets. They're not meter maids anymore. What's traffic enforcement? Whatever they are.
Traffic attendants or something.
But I mean, you read the stories of abuse that these people suffer through.
No, it's absolutely terrible.
So I mean, give them a break. 877.
Jim, it's all about pensions.
877-301-8970. Shauna, we're going to try you again because I'm dying to hear that story. Go ahead, Shauna.
Can you guys hear me?
Much better. Yep. Shoot.
Okay. So, like I said, I did the drive from Philly. I even lived in New York for a few years and would do the drive back and forth all the time, and I still have never just found the time to do it. I just don't hit tolls with lines that often. I really know I need to do it, but it just is a procrastination thing that I just never find the time to do it.
And now, wait a second.
Who's zipping by me every time.
Next Thursday, if you're in Springfield, you can go to the Big E. And sign up with the second. No, hey, Shauna, that is the most pathetic excuse I've heard so far. I went to college in Philadelphia. I lived in New York. I now live here. How long would it, for example, tomorrow, Saturday? Yes, it is. You go to Kowloon's, it'll take you probably 10 minutes, and you'll never have to wait in line again.
But I really think most people are in my boat just procrastination. It is pathetic, but I think. Most people are with me.
Can I tell you, Shauna, next Tuesday we're going to talk to Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School about one of my favorite topics and yours, procrastination. Make sure you tune in.
It is a great point.
Thanks,
it
Shauna.
Is a great point. I wait. My transponder was kind of on the fritz. It wasn't working as well as it should. And I waited the absolute last minute to drive up to Framingham or whatever it was and get a new one. And I arrived 5 minutes before the place closed.
Excuse me. Wait a second. Hold it. I'm reading the press releases. Shauna, you're gone, but I hope you're listening. In addition to these sign-up sessions like Kowloon, mm-hmm. Market Basket, whatever, you ready for this, Marjorie?
Mm-hmm.
You may also join EasyPass online.
I did not know
at mass.gov/EasyPassMA, or you can call a phone number.
I did not know that,
877-627-7745. So you can be a procrastinator, Shauna, and Marjorie now has one. Call the phone number, go online, and when you have a free minute, do it. You don't have to go to a place.
Pete from Winchester. What do you think about transponders, Pete?
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. How are you?
We're
great.
Excellent. Thank you.
That's great. Well, I think there's mostly a problem for poor people that are unbanked. In most cases, they're unbanked. But in other cases, if they are banked, they have only an ATM card. Usually, they select the option not to have money directly transferred from another account. So one day, they might go through that booth, and the red light will just stay on, and they have no money and no place to give it to anyone. And really, there are so many poor people in this country who just disregard them, I think. And one of these transponders are very difficult for them.
You know, I have to say,
that's a good point.
I hadn't thought of it. And next time Rich Davey is in here, because he's actually sensitive to these kinds of things, which obviously we were not. They have to have thought about this thing, but you make what sounds like a pretty sound point.
Well, if there's an answer, I sure would like to hear it. Thank you, guys.
Well, he'll be in. I'm sure he'll be in soon, and keep listening, and you'll hear the best he's got to give.
You know what? But
thanks, Peter.
For the people that do have them, it's another way for the to for the state to perpetuate these high toll amounts of money because you don't really think about what you're spending when you go through the...
I mean, like withdrawal of taxation as opposed to paying taxation.
Yeah, I mean the tolls are going to be there for a long time because we're so in the hole because of the big dick. Yeah.
So why don't you get rid of your transponder?
I'm not going to get rid of my transponder, but it's not like handing a toll taker $7. You're just kind of flying through. Or what is the Tobin Bridge? The Tobin Bridge is a lot of money.
I don't know where it is now.
Yeah, and you have to get some special deal if you live in East Boston because otherwise you couldn't afford to go to work. Let's go to Dine.
That's a pretty decent point. I mean, it is like the argument that a lot of people make. I don't know if you do that. I said a minute ago, for people to understand what I was saying, most anti-tax crusaders say, and I think they're totally right, if instead of withholding of taxation from every paycheck, you had to write a check to the Internal Revenue Service every April 15th, there'd be a revolution yet again in this country.
Yeah, people
which
would go
is
absolutely
a very
bananas.
Good point. Yeah.
Diane from Somerville, what do you think about transponders?
Hi, Diane.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I love your show.
Well, thank you so much.
I've had a transponder from the very beginning, and I love the convenience, but I'm always concerned that I'm not being charged correctly. And there's no way to really know. You can't go back and look at your bill and say, where did I go and how much did that toll cost? And I think that there's something, you know, potentially... tricky about that.
You know, I said a minute ago that I check my bill, which I do, but, you know, you make a very good point, which I hadn't thought about, is even though I check it and it looks fine on its face, is I really don't know. You're right. You don't know. For example, if you use the turnpike, how many of us know how much it costs to go from Newton to the Palmer, Massachusetts exit?
I used to know. Yep.
Well, you had a ticket. You know, that's a pretty good point, Diane, and I don't know what the answer is to that either, but thank you for the call.
Our crack staff says the Tobin Bridge is $3 or $2.50 with an easy pass. That's another thing. They give you a break. Did you already say that?
I said $3.
Okay. No, they give you a break on tolls when you have – it's less money if you have an easy pass.
Oh, that's a very good point. Oh, you save – is that still in existence? Because I know it was. I know, for example, the exit that I'm getting off all the time, the one that goes to Cambridge and Alston,
right,
when it was raised to, I think, $1.50 or something. It stayed at $1.25, or maybe when it was $1.25, it stayed at $1. I don't know if that's the same deal. But to me, far more important than the savings, because it's modest, unless you're a commuter and do it every single day, in which case it's not modest, is the convenience thing. It's just, and I have to say, I said this at the top, and I know this is evil. I do get satisfaction out of driving past all these people waiting there. I don't know what it is.
Lane. Yeah. Remember the guy that got caught a couple of weeks ago
because
he had the fake person in the jet. And there was a great picture of the state trooper holding this head of a guy with a tie and shirt on. But I mean, the HOV lane. I mean, sometimes, you know, it doesn't always work, and you have to go about 5 miles before it works. But coming out of Boston and Route 3, if you can get that HOV lane, you can shove a bunch of people in your car, it is so satisfying.
Even people you don't know, just round them up, shove them in.
If you track the car next, you have to look for a big truck, like a big fish truck.
Exactly.
So that you say, okay, I'm going to beat this truck. And 95% of the time, you will beat that truck to Braintree.
You know what I do?
Time.
Sometimes when I have several people in my car, even if I'm not going south, I take it anyway, just to do the HOV lane so I can look at people and have them look back at me with envy.
While we're on the subject of the HOV lane, there's two HOV lanes, you know, coming out of Boston. The other one is when you are coming down the Mass Pike and you come around the corner right there at the intersection of the Mass Pike.
To do the Quincy thing you're talking about?
You get the HOV lane from just south of Boston all the way down to
that's what
like
I was talking
Mass
about. Which one were you talking about?
There's another one that starts in Dorchester and goes to Braintree, the big HOV lane.
But one of the great great disappointments, I think you'd have to agree, that first HOV thing, it ends so quickly. You're so high, and then you're so low in a matter of minutes. It's a horrible thing. The lines are full. Let's take one or two more quick ones. Jose, you're somewhere in Massachusetts. Obviously, he doesn't want to be tracked either. Jose, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Excellent.
I want to comment on my personal experience last year. I was commuting from Burlington to Uxbridge.
Yep.
And the line for the Easy Pass, specifically in the Western toll coming back at rush hour, was much bigger every single day than the cash one. So that's my reason why I didn't get it.
Really?
Really. So I wish someone else can help me out here and comment on the same, because that was every single day on rush hour at between 5 and 6. Coming from Burlington and on the Western toll, the line was much bigger. And I just went right through to using the cash every single day.
Okay, I think that's anecdotal aberration. That's what I would say about that. I have no idea, but that's my guess. I mean, that's pretty unusual, isn't it, Jose? I mean, every place I go, it's just the opposite. But Maybe there's something unique
that's
about
it. That's why I'm giving you a specific.
Okay. So, we'll get Jim to do some investigative reporting on that and get
I'll
back
be working
to you,
on it this weekend, Jose, and we'll get thank you for your call.
Here's an email from Brian who's talking about all the people that say that they're using cash to keep the toll takers in their job. Mm-hmm. He says, I suppose they also own a horse to keep blacksmiths employed, buy wooden barrels to employ coopers. What's a cooper?
I don't know.
And make operator assistant long distance phone calls to keep operators in a job. And they send telegrams.
A fine point. Hey, thank you for your calls. And by the way, we'll try the unanswered questions. We will communicate them to Rich Davies office and try to get you answers.
You know
in the
something?
Next few days.
One thing we should say really quickly about the Mass Pike.
Yeah.
You notice all the signs over the Mass Pike now? Put down your cell phone. LOL. Can wait.
Yeah.
They have these funny little signs.
Yeah,
on the
I think
side
they're pretty
the
cute. Yeah.
And they have another one. You know, the whole thing. Keep calm and carry on. That was a line from I think it was World War II. The Brits had that going. Now it's keep calm and. Drive on or something like that. Yeah. They have all these cute little.
Well, they also have the Boston accent thing. I can't think of what the expression
is.
That's fairly clever.
Yeah, it's
use your blinka. Thank you.
That's right.
Spell
K-A-H.
But you know what the only problem is? We've seen it 400 times. After the first 399, it's sort of. Do you agree? It sort of loses its
hey, well,
whatever.
Well, you know, I guess you spent a lot of time in the Max Pass Pike slithering around, Jim.
In any case, maybe.
Coming up, why are Bay Staters pro-casino and anti-voting? From high-stakes gambling to low voter turnout, Callie Crossley joins us for that conversation on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Charlie Sennett, co-founder of Global Post and head of the Ground Truth Project.
We're looking at human rights stories around the world. We're looking at religious extremism. We're looking at global health. And we're trying to take those stories that feel so far away and so distant out there in the world and bring them home through strong storytelling. And when we're here at WGBH Radio, through really bringing in the local angle.
The Ground Truth Project, now a partner with WGBH News.
WGBH Radio exists because of you and the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the Lincoln MKC with available active noise control that works to reduce unwanted cabin noise. More at Lincoln.com. That's Lincoln.com. And Private School Innovator, hosting a private school forum September 13th at the Marriott Burlington with representatives from more than 30 Massachusetts private schools. PrivateSchoolInnovator.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan joining us in Studio 3, as she does every Friday, is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, and that obviously would be Callie Crossley. Hi, Callie.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Good afternoon, Callie Crossley. Thank you for being here with us. So let's start with this whole casino conundrum thing. More and more bad news coming out. We just learned a huge Atlantic City casino shuts down. Meanwhile, we have this ballot question in November that will ask people whether they want to get rid of the casino law in Massachusetts or not. Pro-casino side still has a huge majority, almost 60% in the latest poll, UMass Lowell poll with Channel 7. What do you make of it?
I am completely confused. I really am.
Yeah.
In this way, because what's happening, even if you didn't, let's say you started fresh and you didn't believe any of that and you're yay casinos. And then you see what's happening in Atlantic City for all the reasons the opponents here have been saying all along, which is that when you have all these other casinos in other states, it makes your casino less valuable. And so people stop coming. So therefore you have no money. So therefore all these promised jobs, don't exist. Of course, I've not seen these promised jobs because it's my position. So I just don't get why people don't look at Atlantic City as not just a canary in the mine, but the whole mine has exploded. hello, this is what we're about to do.
But you didn't tell the whole Atlantic City story. You mentioned the most recent one. That means by the end of the year, 4 of the 12 casinos in the city that I used to spend my summers, and boy, was it a dump then. You know the great line, I've quoted it 1,400 times, is this guy from UMass Amherst. His great line was Atlantic City used to be a slum by the ocean. Now it's a slum by the ocean with casinos, which is pretty much what it is. Yeah. So the Connecticut casinos, making your point, Callie, gambling revenue is down. So for those listening, it doesn't matter whether you're for or against casinos. What we're commenting on is it's amazing that the electorate is not asking more questions than it seems to be asking, even if at the end of the day they say, we want casinos in the Commonwealth. You know who was right?
Who?
The kid from Dorchester, Shelley Adelson, the guy who owns the Sands, who decided not to get involved bidding for a casino here because he said the market's going to be oversaturated with three casinos and a slots parlor.
That's right.
And at least the objective evidence suggests that they don't care. So how do you explain the—by the way, no huge ads by the casinos yet, and they're yet to come. How do you explain the imbalance in the polls?
I think people are not paying attention. And so I would urge people, even if you just take a cursory glance at what is happening in Atlantic City, even if you just know one story of what's going on there, that should give you some pause about what we're doing here. Now, what gives me pause is that we've put an infrastructure in place. And now what? We're going to have to untangle it if, you know, this thing is repealed. And that is an issue. But I have to say, looking at the impact of Atlantic City, that big casino that they put all that money into, promised everything for, only lasted 2 years. It's shocking how many jobs have gone away.
5,000 in Atlantic City,
yes,
I think is the number.
And what's kind of, it's really shocking. I just don't get it.
Here's my analysis based on nothing except anecdote. The argument that Marjorie and I have been talking about the casino issue for years and years
Rhode
on
Island
the radio.
Too.
Yes.
That's a good point. But I think the argument that has been around for so long, that is in people's heads, that is very hard to contradict, is remember when you first read it? No. 40% of the license plates at Mohegan Sun and Foxwoods in Connecticut are license plates of people from Massachusetts. Mm. Why should we lose that revenue?
Yes.
Now, you can debate that, but that's a number that has stayed with me for a long time.
Who said it? Steve Grossman just said it yesterday when
he was in here. I know, but they continue, right? Exactly. They continue. That's an argument that I think has been around so long that I think it has some staying power with people. Why should we give up the revenue?
Okay, but this is how I come back and say, show me, and then maybe I'll shut up, maybe. Where are the communities that got the school money, that got the big improvements in, you know, all kinds of other infrastructure that is promised as a result of this? Just show it to me. And then show me the people that got the jobs initially. I'm talking about the construction jobs. Those people will get in and get out. I'm talking long-term jobs in which they have a livable wage and that raised up the community overall.
You mean if they build it, will they come?
Yeah. Show me those two things and maybe I say, okay.
Remember Mitt Romney's?
I just don't know it. You know?
Remember Mitt Romney's idea?
It was the most brilliant idea.
Yeah.
For anti-casino
people
ever. Mitt Romney said, I think when he was still governor, his position, he was anti-casino. I am right. He was anti-casino. And his position is that we should go to Connecticut, to Foxwoods, or maybe to Connecticut, the state, I guess, and say, give us $250 million a year and we will never open a casino.
Meaning,
I'm with him. You don't want the competition, then
right.
pay
right.
for
right.
the absence of competition.
That's a much better deal as far as I'm concerned.
But, and it may, in all fairness, and again, this is not a pro or anti-casino. This is a huge issue about the culture of Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Well, you have said it.
You know.
This is hopefully something people are really going to focus on post-primary.
Yeah.
And we are too. So in any case, that's where that thing is.
Yeah.
Speaking of elections,
yes,
more depressing to me than the fact that that evidence seems to not be part of at least the debate on the casino front. When I read Bill Galvin, the Secretary of State, who's generally pretty accurate in his predictions about turnout,
sadly.
When he talked about turnout predictions for the primary, pretty open governor seat, open, obviously, lieutenant governor, open treasurer, open, well, what else? Auditor is not open. I mean, there's an incumbent running for re-election.
Did you say attorney general?
Open attorney general. And the fact that he's predicting 20% turnout?
And that, I don't think he's real clear that we're going to make 20%. And by the way, because I fear people don't know when the primary is, it's next Tuesday.
Yeah, Tuesday.
So let's just say that. But here's part of the fact that I thought was very interesting and probably adds to it. 53% of Massachusetts citizens are registered as independents.
Mm-hmm.
And people are mostly driven, you know, if they're party affiliated. So if you're not party affiliated, that adds to your, maybe I go, maybe I don't pay attention.
But you can vote in either primary
if you're
unenrolled.
Yeah. Yes, but I'm just saying there is a driver there that if you feel party affiliated that you may not feel as an independent. And so that could be contributing to it. At the same time, I'm just such a Pollyanna about this. You know, I really am. I don't care if the dog catcher is running. I mean, get in there and vote. You know, you just got to. Now, I recognize that there's a lot of new names and they're flying around. And by the way, I am not as up to date as I will be on Tuesday when I vote. But I will be able to go in there and cast a ballot, and I will have done some work. And it's easy to get to now. You can listen to debates. You're doing them. You can go online. I mean, all the stuff. I know I sound like the civic Pollyanna, but daggone it, this stuff's important.
I wonder whether there's just such a big disconnect between large swaths of people and the sense that their government is doing the right thing or even the wrong thing by them. We talked about this during the probation scandal, which I thought was just a terrible disgrace, a job-rigging scheme going on, depriving people of jobs and promotions that they deserved in a very important position. And no one seemed to get riled up. And the theory was no one got riled up because they just thought, hey, well, this is a typical.
This is what happens.
This is patronage and corruption. This is just what goes on. And you look at how people think so horribly about Congress now, that part of that comes back. And also I heard on our station driving in a couple mornings ago, numbers about young people listening
to
the news.
Yeah.
What do they say? They listen maybe once a month,
right.
So,
well, you can even be more specific about young people and voting, which is something I speak about quite a bit. And they are, you know, and this is confirmed by polling done over by the Harvard School, Harvard's Kennedy School and the Institute of Politics. They are completely shut down because they are so like, really? This is how it works? I'm not interested.
Exactly.
These scummy people I don't want to have any affiliation with. And so why vote? Because I don't see how my vote counts. And so I try to spend a lot of time, and I know you all do too, saying it does matter. And when we have these big issues, as in Ferguson, I pointed out, 70% of the people there not voting. But guess what's happening now? The results passed post-Ferguson and Michael Brown's death. Voting registration efforts are huge on the ground because there is some connection to people like, this is who you put in place? This is the leadership you wanted? No, I don't think so. So you better try to figure out how to vote them out.
Couple of thoughts here, if I can. One, not to defend people who don't vote at all. Having a primary 8 days after Labor Day is insane. The Secretary of State is quoted in the Herald as saying there's some federal requirement. I don't understand what the federal requirement is. We'll get to the bottom of that. But I believe every New England state except Vermont, I think I'm right, votes. Their primary is on September 9th. So it's not much of a defense. If I could come up with a technology, Marjorie's going to bristle at this, but I mean this, that would disallow a non-voter from complaining about anything that the person who is elected does or doesn't do, I would do it. If there was some app that could put tape over the mouth of the non-voters, it is scandalous. And by the way, Marjorie, every time we have this discussion, I'll preempt Marjorie. Marjorie interrupts and says, oh, Jim, do you want to be like one of those countries that mandates voting? Some of them, by the way, some Western nations, if you don't vote, you're fined a small amount.
Yes.
You're fined. I'm not crazy about that solution, but if the choice was between mandated voting and 20% turnout in a huge and important primary.
That's not a good idea either. You know why it's not a good idea? Because to me, one of the worst things of all is people getting into the voting booth and have no idea who they're voting for. So do you want people making random guesses at people? I mean, I must admit, I get into the voting booth and we're talking about governors, council. Who is this person? I have no idea.
Well, I hate them so.
I leave it blank. But I mean, that's what you're promoting. Is voting completely unaware of the issues.
You know what would do? There was a guy, he's since died.
You know, we interviewed a guy. The ballot questions. They could be so confusing. You're in there for half an hour trying
about
to
what's
figure
a yes
out.
And what's a no.
Yes, exactly. But I will say that, you know, our own Edgar B. Herrick did a whole piece about how they put that one line in there to explain to you what your vote means on the ballot questions. But you read
A couple of years ago, we interviewed a guy, and I'm pretty sure he has since died. He had filed a bill with the legislature. He's from the Cape. And he said that if the legislature didn't pass it, which it didn't, he was then going to collect signatures to put it on the ballot, which would put an option on every, I guess, state ballot, because you can't change federal election laws state by state, which none of the above.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, getting back to disenfranchised young people, disenfranchised older people, if we had none of the above on the ballot. I'm serious about this. You don't think turnout would go up dramatically?
I believe it would.
What's wrong with that? But the end of the notion was, and if none of the above either prevails, or something like either prevails, or if the other candidates on the ballot combined don't get to 50%, then the election, the results are null and void, and they've got to do the thing all over again. I mean, why are we not leading that campaign?
Well, the only problem is, of course, then you have the wheels of government must keep turning, and then so you have this nobody's in place, and some decisions have to be made.
That's a price you pay for lack of involvement or poor candidates.
Very instructive. We all remember Tim Murray. He was formerly the lieutenant governor in Massachusetts. How long has he been gone?
A few years.
No. almost 18 months.
Okay.
Has anybody missed him? Have we missed what he was doing when he was here that he's not doing now because there is no lieutenant governor?
You know, I won't embarrass anybody in the room, including myself, in saying, can you name, speaking of lieutenant governor, can you name the, we know the Republican candidate's Karen Pulido, because obviously Charlie Baker picked her as his running mate. Can you name the three Democratic candidates for a job if the next governor decides to leave to become ambassador to Mexico or Canada like Cellucci and Weld wanted to do?
Steve Kerrigan and Leland Chung. Now the
that's
third
two.
One is escaping
that's very
me.
Good. Is it, yeah. Okay, I'm going to
give you a hint. He worked for
L.
the Obama administration. It does begin with an L. Well, that's a
Lake.
Good start. Lake. Very
oh, right.
good.
Michael Lake, right?
Mike Lake. Yeah.
That's that the one endorsed by... Is that he's endorsed by somebody big?
I don't know.
Okay, right.
It was
okay.
a pure guess.
That was a good guess, though.
That
you got
name
the L
was
right.
floating around somewhere.
Michael
in my
Lake,
head.
I'll know your story by Tuesday.
Yeah.
In any case,
or you can leave it blank. You know,
no,
leave it blank.
It's Friday, Monday, and Tuesday. We're going to urge you to vote again. And again, Marjorie's right. You got to be informed. It's but then get informed because this is or shut up is the bottom line.
Yes. Since I'm not shutting up, I'll be informed.
No, and I'm going to do my best too. Can we move from something depressing to something actually quite wonderful?
Oh, isn't it wonderful?
Tell the story about what's about to happen to the Mass Ave Bridge. That's what we all call it. It's the Harvard Bridge.
Right.
Tell what's about to happen. And I totally love this.
I love it, too. There's an anonymous donor who is giving a lot of money, $2.5 million, to put lights underneath the canal area so that the boaters will have light, but really strung along the bridge. So it'll be just lit up, you know, really in a most beautiful way. You know those little tiny Christmas lights that people sometimes leave up? It'll have
Marjorie
sort
does.
Of that.
I do.
Have that effect, but overall on the bridge. It'll be... just
gorgeous.
Gorgeous and so peaceful. And it's the kind of thing I read this and I thought, wow, you know, if I ever had money, this is the kind of thing I would love to do. Just an anonymous donor spending his or her own money, wanting to provide a beautiful aesthetic for the city. And it's also something that offers some safety because there's more light going around. I just cannot wait.
You know what? You know, it's one of my favorite things to do in the world in Boston is to drive over the Mass Ave Bridge or one of the other bridges. I forget the name that's up further up. But anyway,
Salt and Pepper Bridge?
Whatever it is.
Yeah.
And you drive over and then you look to your left as you're heading into Boston from Cambridge and look at the city.
Right.
Or coming down Memorial Drive, that same drive toward the city, you look up and you can see Beacon Hill in the Back Bay. It's the most beautiful view of Boston.
Well, what's one of the most... Talk about new things. And Boston is, I think, one of the most beautiful cities. But talk about something relatively new and it's relevant to this Mass Ave Bridge story. What's one of the most beautiful things in Boston today? The lit up Lenny Zakin Bridge.
Oh, absolutely.
At night. I mean, it's a beautiful bridge, beautifully constructed and designed. And remember, by the way, in a couple of years ago, for 10 days, I looked this up this morning, for 10 days, the Zakin Bridge went dark because the Mass Turnpike Authority ran out of money.
Right.
And then I can't remember how, but they finally came up with $5,000 a month or
was
whatever
that an
it was.
Anonymous donor
I don't know if it was.
Yeah,
but,
okay.
And that's another thing.
Yeah.
If you, I don't care how rich you are.
Yeah.
If you gave $2.5 million to light up the Mass Ave Bridge that everybody is going to love and benefit from, can you imagine doing it in anonymity? I'm sorry. That's not part of my genetic makeup.
We know that, Jim.
But well, I think that's. I just think it's beautiful. And this is a there. You know, he went right to the Charles River Conservatory, which is a nonprofit group that handles all of this. I just think it's beautiful and it's so wonderful.
You know, I remember when Todd English ran that famous restaurant Olive's over in Charlestown, and it got in trouble because supposedly there were rats in there or something like that. It's no longer in business.
Not supposedly. It was shut down.
It was shut down. Okay, there were some rats there. And I went to dinner there, and I thought I didn't really care if there were rats there because the food was so good. I didn't, you know, a few rats, what are you going to do, you know? But I remember looking at dinner there out on the Zakin Bridge, and it was just spectacular. I mean, it's just like driving over from Cambridge to Boston, sitting in Charleston looking at the Zakin Bridge. It's one of those great views.
You know what's there now, by the way? I was there a couple of weeks ago.
What?
Roger Berkowitz's new, the Legal Oysteria in the exact same spot.
Right. Really? Yeah.
And when you walk in, and is it called City Square? I'm sorry, I can't remember where it is in Charleston. If you haven't been there before, you don't have to go to the restaurant, even though it's a wonderful restaurant. You are literally what seems to be on top of the bridge, as Marjorie said. And the sight of the structure and the lights, it really is as beautiful as anything
there is in
Boston.
And if you've traveled at all, you've been in other cities where those bridges are lit up, and it just you know what that beauty is. You know, and this will be aesthetically beautiful, but just has a the civic part of this, I'm just so appreciative of.
I agree.
I've always felt that the Zakim Bridge, not in the lighting of it, was kind of a spiritual thing because of who Lenny Zakim was.
Yes.
So those lights feel like that's his spirit in some way to me. I hate to get, you know, sentimental, but that's how I feel. And I think this may have a shot of bringing some of that, you know, to another piece, part of the city.
You're talking Zakim is a Bill Bridger between Jewish Americans and African Americans.
Head of the Anti-Defamation League.
Yeah, all the work he did on that kind of stuff. Yeah. It was really great. So who do we think this person is, the donor?
I don't know, but I'm just so impressed. I really am. Whoever
you guesses?
Are,
can I say? Yeah,
donor.
I do. And I know we're going to get emails about this.
Okay, well,
yeah, feel free to email us if you want to guess.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get into my involvement in this at all. I'm not going to confirm or deny
that you gave the 2.5.
Just because I don't want to get, you know, one last thing about the Zakim thing.
And
I know one of the, remember Matt Amarello who got in a lot of trouble?
Yes, I do.
One of the great things.
He used to run the turnpike.
I've never asked a public official for anything with one exception. Do you remember who performed at the opening of the Zakim Bridge?
Bruce Springsteen.
Yes. Bruce Springsteen did an acoustic version of Thunder Road.
That's right.
Because apparently he and Lenny Zakim, because of Zakim's work, was, and by the way, Lenny Zakim's kid, Josh, is now a city councilor.
Right.
And
I'm
sure you've interviewed.
Yes, yes, I have.
And he played Thunder Road, and I didn't get to the thing, and I'm pretty ethical. I called Matt Amarello and said, can I get a tape, a VHS in those days, of Springsteen doing Thunder Road at the opening, and he sent it to me. Did I violate some journalistic statute of limitations?
I think you made up for it with your $2.5 million.
No, I'm neither confirming. So, Kelly, Sunday night, what are you doing?
We're going to be doing a lot of politics leading up because, you know, it's only a couple days before the primary. Looking at, you know, women's roles as well, because I have the great Kelly Bates and Erin O'Brien to talk about that and have that focus. But we're also continuing a bit of a women's theme in my Lanyap segment, talking about the campus activism around campus rape. Students are coming back to school, and a lot has changed since some of these legal filings have happened under Title IX, using that as a legal muscle. And by the way, now most of these activists who were raped themselves are right out front about it, and they're being very assertive in not allowing schools to sort of do nothing about how they have handled the cases in the past. So we'll be talking about that.
Well, you said there's two things up front.
Emerson just noted.
I'm just going to say the president of Emerson has done great work on this. And Wendy Murphy, our buddy, who really started this whole Title IX thing when most of us thought Title IX was just about sports access for women, is really done some wonderful work too. Kelly, we'll be listening.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Kelly Crossley joins us every Friday. Of course, you can keep up with her Sunday nights at 6 o'clock for Under the Radar with Kelly Crossley. Great to see you, Kelly, as always. Up next, Malcolm Rogers, the director of the Museum of Fine Arts, joins us. He's been at the MFA for 20 years. How he's taken Boston arts and culture scene from the 20th to the 21st century is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. Chef Chris Coombs from Boston Chops.
The WGBH Food and Wine Festival, all the chefs really try and bring their A game, so I'm going to bring my best as well. Last year, we really went all out. We did whole roasted ducks. There was a line of people, 50 people long. This year, I might even take it a little bit further.
Check out Chris's delicious recipe for ribeye steak when you pick up your tickets to the Taste of WGBH Food and Wine Festival. Online at wgbh.org/festival.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Simmons Leads, a resource for women's leadership and development, presenting the Encore series on October 1st with a full day of programming to help move your career forward. You can visit simmons.edu/leadership to register. And Celebrity Cruises. You can discover the world with Celebrity Cruises and relax knowing you can do as much or as little as you choose. That's modern luxury. Details at 1-800-CELEBRITY or your travel agent. Ships Registry Malta.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3, and we're quite happy about it, is Malcolm Rogers. Malcolm's the longest-serving director at the Museum of Fine Arts. This week marks his 20th anniversary at the MFA. Mayor Marty Walsh has declared this Sunday Malcolm Rogers Day as a way of honoring the work he's done for making the MFA more accessible, welcoming to the public, and for increasing the city's profile as an arts and culture destination. Malcolm, it's great to see you.
Great to be here.
Great to talk to you at last. So you, in much of that's been written about you, people say that you have revolutionized the Museum of Fine Arts. So are you a revolutionary kind of guy over there, Malcolm?
Half of me is conservative and half of me likes throwing sticks of dynamite. I think one of the things that makes me conservative in my approach to the museum is taking the museum back to its original 19th century philanthropic roots. It's a place for everyone. That was the idea of those wealthy, intellectual, public-spirited founders, and I'm working in their spirit.
Well, that's a, you know, when we were talking about you this morning, and actually when we were talking about you when Jared Bowen spoke to you recently, the first thing that comes to mind about you, and there are many, was the controversial, and I can't believe it was, opening of the main door to the MFA on Huntington Avenue. I was reading about it this morning, an article from years ago when you'd done it after it had been closed, what, 10 years or something like that, that one of the curators said it was a frivolous decision. What was it? Because the great unwashed were going to enter the MFA? Was that what the problem was?
I think people wanted to show when I arrived that the museum was suffering. Nobody cares if the museum is suffering. They want the museum to be a great place to come to with a very positive attitude about life and about changing people's lives.
But what was the thing? I mean, it really was to say, to at least as I saw it, it was you waving to the community and saying, really, come on in. This is not that kind of stuffy institution that you may think it is or may have heard it is. It's for you. It's your museum.
Absolutely. It was symbolic, but also powerfully practical. And over the 20 years, what I've been working on is this whole idea of accessibility. What are the barriers to people enjoying art? What are the barriers to bringing it into their lives? And one of them is, you know, the museum looks like a bank or a fortress or a prison. So I'm thrilled that my 20 years are being bookended by a free community day on Sunday. A bit shy that it's named after me, but I'm thrilled that it's a free community
day. You know, when I read about all this stuff, I felt for a second, I said, has this guy died? Or, I mean, you realize, I mean, it is almost that kind of... Yeah. We're going to talk about some of the wonderful things that are going on in honor of this day in a couple of minutes.
But, you know, you mentioned making it for everybody. Tell people that may not even know this, there are a lot of things at the MFA that you can bring your kids to sort of interactively that I don't think people are even aware of.
Absolutely. Well, again, you can regard the Community Day on Sunday as a taster for the kind of things that are going on all the time at the museum. As director, I take responsibility for everything, but I cannot possibly know about every program. But, you know, on Sunday there's going to be work on silversmithing, on glassmaking, of course, all the aspects of art making. I mean, just such a range.
Well, I'll tell you, because I brought my kids there when they were little. You could go, and you were there then. You could go in, and you get, like, drawing lessons, and everything was supplied, the paper and the crayons and stuff like that. And you go sit in that main, this big, huge room. I don't know the name of it, but you could bring your children, little kids, like 4 years old and 6 years old. Yeah. Old and 8 years old, and it was a great thing because then you could bring them from there to see, you know, some of these scary looking Egyptians in there and the tombs and all that kind of stuff.
I love that scary thing.
Exactly. Well, you know, for little kids, it was sort of a big adventure, and these and all the you know, the ancient art you've got there as well. So I think children may not think, you know, or teenagers think, oh, the MFA, but when they've been there and seen it and have these opportunities come in as little kids, it just builds a new audience.
I can remember my first visit to a museum, and, you know, I was 5 or 6, I think. And what was it? My parents said, this is something special. You remember one or two things. And then as you mature, and particularly when you become a student, museums are already a tiny bit of your life, and then you can really get to love a museum in your college or school town or whatever. And that's what happens in Boston in an amazing way.
You know, one of the things you get to do, I don't know if you do this, but I hope the answer to this is yes. Do you ever, when the place is locked up at night and you're sitting in your office, say, I'm going to walk around this place all by myself no one there and get to look at the brilliance that is on every wall. Do you ever do that? Please say yes, Malcolm
Rogers. A little bit. Remember, we're open three nights a
week. Okay, fine. But if you say, I'm serious.
He's there at 2 in the
morning.
Have
you done that? The solitude of that must be absolutely stunning.
It is wonderful. I can visit some of my favorite things, though. I also love seeing people interacting with the art. I mean, that really recharges my batteries. Kids, but also people of all ages, it recharges my batteries because I so believe in that mission.
Well, stay there one second. Yeah, when Jared Bowen interviewed you, I was really surprised by one of your answers. One of the things he was talking about was the advent of selfie taking.
Oh, yes.
Somebody standing in front of one of the great works of art and taking a picture of themselves. I assumed you were going to say, in your incredibly polite way, you were going to say... And I'll do the translation. You're going to say something. I'm totally appalled by this. But you wouldn't say it that way because you're Malcolm Rogers. You not only were not appalled by it, you love it. Why?
Because taking a selfie of yourself with a work of art establishes a relationship between you and that work of art more profound than just the 10-second glance, something you want to memorialize and share with your friends, share with the world if you want on Facebook or Instagram. And that personalizing of the experience of art to me is very important. And anyway, you can't stop it. It's going to happen. But I see it as a very encouraging sign.
We talked with Malcolm Rogers, who's the director of the MFA, the 20-year director of the MFA. You just mentioned your favorite things. What are some of your favorite things?
Well, I always love, because I come from the portrait world, some of the great portraits in the museum. You can't beat John Singer Sargent's Boy Daughters, for instance, or El Greco's Fray Hortensio, probably El Greco's greatest portrait, the Roger van der Weyden of St. Luke painting the Virgin Mary, which I feel might be a self-portrait. Magical work.
The Daughters one is the one with the little girls in the white dresses?
That's right.
Oh,
that's
that
right.
Is a great one.
It's one of the greatest paintings of childhood in existence. But then, I also love some of the great Egyptian statues. I love European decorative arts. The silver, for instance, we have a great, great collection. Perhaps it's a minority taste, but to me, it's extraordinary.
Okay, yeah. Since you're being honest, Malcolm Rogers, I think I'll be honest for a minute. Several years ago, you had an exhibit there, and I think it was for my television work. I had to do something on this, and I called Marjorie on the phone. We were on the radio together then, and I said, you will not believe what I've got to do this weekend. And she said, what? I said, I've got to go see the most ridiculous thing. There is an exhibit of Ralph Lauren collection automobiles at the Museum of Fine Arts. Is this ridiculous? I went and saw it because I was required to. I called you immediately after. What did I say to you?
They were fantastic and beautiful.
One of the most
beautiful.
They were
works of art, really, in some
You took some huge sense. Heat for that. You took huge heat for Herberts, the so-called celebrity photographer.
Yeah.
How hard is it to make those kinds of decisions when you know in your heart you're right, but you know the kind of crap you're going to take, Malcolm Rogers?
Well, I'm, the director of the museum. I'm here to take the crap, as you put it. But you have to do what's right. And critically for me, was the issue of changing the brand of the museum and bringing in some exhibitions that were more approachable, but also, and this is critical to me, bringing in objects that people hadn't thought of being in museums. And then they'd look at them and say, wow, these things are beautiful. There was a designer behind this, someone who knew about materials, about finishes. I'll never look at a car the same way again. That's what museums are to do in part.
Well, there were those famous DeLorean cars that we all had heard.
The Gullwing.
Had heard so much about. And when you saw them and you could get very close to these cars, because this is another thing I took my kids to. They were, maybe work of art is going overboard, but they were in some sense because they were just beautiful machines.
Great people took pride in creating them, and that's important. And I think when you say a car can be a work of art, I would particularly say a car can be a piece of sculpture.
I was going to use that word, absolutely.
And I think about that in other areas, and we've looked at musical instruments in that way. And most critically, recently, we had a curatorship of jewellery endowed, and I absolutely see jewellery as small sculpture.
What kind of, but you, I wanted to get back to what I said a minute ago. What's your level of self-confidence? I don't know you. Are you the kind of person who says, I know I'm right about this, I can live with whatever heat I take? Or are you, I'm serious. I mean,
well, sometimes I just feel I'm right, but the people who work with me will know that I'm not dictatorial. I do many things by suggestion, but if I get a positive response, then I have no hesitation about going with it. And of course, I'm surrounded with people who are bold, confident, thinking about how we express the museum's mission in new ways. So I have a team, but I have to lead it, but mm-hmm. I don't have to bully it.
That's the voice of Malcolm Rogers, obviously. He is the director of the MFA, and at some point in the relatively near future will no longer be the director of the MFA. We'll talk about that too.
But you're also surrounded by people that are very critical. I mean, it's not like you're running a Denny's restaurant. You are running a place where people have a real snobbery about art. I mean, they've got their master's degree in art history, or they're experts in art, and it's like they have a lot of free time to criticize and go crazy about everything you do. It's hard you have a very difficult audience to try to both please and placate when you go off in a direction that makes them upset.
Well, in some ways, I say I run what is a medium-sized to large corporation, but where every stakeholder has a different bottom line, a different sense of what the profit is. Now, I think the museum is a place for art historians, but it also is a place for kids or grown-ups who've never set foot in a museum before, don't really know what a work of art is. So we have to work across the whole spectrum and never seem to be turning people away from our doors.
Speaking of spectrum, boomers, one audience, millennials, another audience, and obviously many more. How do you balance all those kinds of things to make sure you've got what the full spectrum of people want to see?
Well, I think, it is. It's like mixing a cocktail. And so you have, as we have this fall, a great Goya exhibition opening, one of the greatest artists of all time, very, very serious. And then we're balancing it with an exhibition about Hollywood glamour. It is really a cocktail, and that tells you something about the artistic diversity and the emotional diversity that's latent in a great organization like ours.
How often is your judgment wrong? Meaning, when you say, this really, I guess, harkens back not just to the Ralph Lauren thing, but a lot of, when you say, I know this is going to hit with a particular demographic that matters to us, how often do you call it incorrectly, would you say?
Well,
it's
not a science, it's an art. So knowing how many people an exhibition will appeal to is very, very difficult indeed. It's always a guess. Though I think we're finding that, how shall I put it, the more inventive, innovative exhibitions and the ones that have a what I'd call a personalized component in them are proving more and more attractive. Just as we did Boston Loves Impressionism and crowdsourced it. It relates to that selfie question. How do you build the bond with people?
Well, what have been the mega sellers, the biggest hits in your 20 years? What exhibits drew the most people?
Well, as always, a great favorite is Monet. So Monet in the 20th century early on.
Huge.
And then we could bookend that with Dale Chihuly quite recently.
That was the glass?
The glass, yes.
Oh, God, that was incredible.
Yeah.
When you walk into that and you have that ceiling above you with all the different colored glass,
yes.
That was really neat.
And we still have in the Shapiro Courtyard that great green icicle tower, which is like a smile on the face of the museum.
Explain to people what that was. He was a glass blower? Is that what he was, this guy?
He was a guy.
I shouldn't dismiss him. He's a great artist.
This guy, Dale Chihuly, the very approachable, the very approachable great great artist, well, is a glass maker because he's worked in various forms of glass. So blowing is part of it. The thing about glass is it's such an approachable medium. It does what a great deal of art was intended to do. It moves light around in a magical way. But glass does it in a very, very special way indeed.
And that was a big one.
Very big.
That was a big one. Okay.
Do you feel Doris Kearns Goodwin was here a few months ago, and we were—I don't know what—we were talking about her latest book, but we also harkened back to Team of Rivals, and one of us said to her, "Do you feel like you knew Lincoln? I don't mean knew about Lincoln, but knew Lincoln based upon your 10 years of research." And she said, without missing a beat, "Yes, she did." When you're so close, we mentioned Goya before, just as one example. Do you feel after a period of time when you've been so close to the work of masters that you know them in any way other than just knowing what they put on canvas? Do you know what I mean?
Well, two answers. First of all, if you look at the Goya exhibition this fall, it's going to be all about Goya and how his artistic, his imagination, his artistic mind worked. So, yes, we're going to give great insights into Goya. But the really great artists always leave you thinking, next time I see that painting, next time I hear that symphony, I'll really understand it. They always leave something to give you that feeling you'll discover more next time.
Mark and Roger, do you have anything to do with this museum store? Because I love the museum store as well. Is that in your purview?
It is.
How about the restaurants?
Well, interestingly, it relates.
Two of them.
Those guys who work in the restaurants. How about them?
Well, let me go back to basics. I don't know whether you know, but the Museum of Fine Arts is the world's largest, almost certainly, privately funded museum. We don't receive any money from our city, virtually nothing from Massachusetts.
Which is disgraceful in many ways. I was stunned
to
find
that
out.
I'm not going to say that.
No money from Boston, a small grant from Massachusetts. I saw that in Jared Bowen's interview.
So, two things. We're very dependent on a diverse stream of revenue. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely the case. But also, like the issue of the selfie, people want a complete experience, a quality experience in the museum, whether it's a quality meal, a quality drink, a good shopping experience. It all has to do with that experience in the museum.
Do you know, I know we're here to talk about the Museum of Fine Arts, but do you have a couple of favorite museums, either in America or around the world, that you think, if you were telling someone after they go to the MFA, where else to go?
Well, I think I'm going to nominate places that are completely different from the MFA, because we're a great, great world encyclopedic museum. But particularly close to my heart are some of the small boutique museums, like the Gardner here, the Frick in New York, the Wallace Collection in London.
What's the Wallace Collection in London?
Where is it?
What is it?
Well, it's just off Oxford Street. It's really the collection of one man, Sir Richard Wallace, formed in the 19th century. And it is like a miniature encyclopedic museum, except it doesn't really have the ancient world there. Some of the greatest European paintings, armour, glass, sculpture, tapestries. Fantastic.
You a baseball fan?
I have thrown the first pitch at a
you
Red
have
Sox
not.
Game.
Did you bounce it, or how nervous were
it
you?
It went straight to the glove, but it was a pretty feeble throw.
Did you practice in the museum? I practiced
on the front lawn of the museum.
Is that really true?
Yes.
I love that. Well, the reason I ask that is I'm looking at you and I'm saying, here's this iconic figure in Boston and in the arts community who is leaving on the top of your game. People say in baseball, for example, everybody quits when they're forced out. They don't quit on their own terms. Sandy Koufax is about the only person I can think of who decided I've had enough. Why are you leaving this? You are an iconic figure in this community and beyond. The museum could not be more explosive and in the lives of people in this community. No, I mean, it's true. So why are you doing this?
Well, I'm 65, and 15 years I'll be 80. This is always my answer.
We could have done that math, by the way. Yeah.
So, you know, there's a chance for another phase in life, not necessarily another full-time job, but to do some of the other things that I've always wanted to do.
Like what?
I'd like to travel more, listen to music more. I'd like to do some research. I'd actually, and people find this strange, as a director of a museum, I don't spend enough time actually in the art world, visiting art galleries, other museums, going to sales. So I'll have time, I think, to have a different experience of art from the MFA experience.
Are you worried? I mean, you're so identified with the work you've done here for two decades. Are you worried at all about life after? I know you're looking forward to these things, but you have this stable, solid thing which has made you who you are in the mind. I'm serious. Mm-hmm. Do you worry about life after it all?
No, I don't. And sometimes people have asked me, do you feel you've made any mistakes? And
I was going to ask that in a minute.
Well, and I've always said, no, I'm always looking, everything is a step forward from which you learn. And that's my attitude. I wouldn't say I was Pollyanna-ish, but I always believe that there is a future in store, that the next phase will be fascinating.
Okay, so when the successor, you're, I assume, involved in the picking of your successor. You're staying until your successor
is chosen. I'm not involved in picking
okay,
my
so when
successor.
He or she is selected, and he or she comes to you and says, Malcolm, give me a little advice as to what how I should follow in your foot or not follow in your footsteps. What do you say to this man or woman?
I would say to anyone, follow the museum's mission, which is that broad educational, cultural mission. and make sure that you address that mission as something that affects a whole community, not just one part of the community.
Okay, can we discuss Malcolm Rogers Day? How weird do you feel about that, first of all?
I feel a little bit like a poodle that's just been clipped. Do you know what I mean?
So what is this MR20 thing? Yeah, we do know what you mean. 20 reasons to visit the MFA, which is related to what's that deal? What's going
well,
on?
Well, 20 has something to do with my
We understand the concept 20. There, too. Thank you. Go ahead.
I think it's fair to say that it's a marketing concept, but it is something that stresses the sheer range, variety of things that are going on within our walls.
And it's if you go to MFA.org, correct, /MR20,
yeah.
You get a list of these things.
I believe you do. And you can hear later in the fall me lecturing on 20 people who've changed my life at the museum. And then next in the spring, I think I'm lecturing on 20 acquisitions at the museum or 20.
You know why that is, by the way? Because you've been there 20 years. You know that's
believe,
why they picked the 20 thing, Malcolm.
I believe.
Okay. Well, you run a great museum, and it's brought a lot of fun to me and my
changed
kids.
Changed lives.
And,
you really? Yeah, my so kids, by the way, just to throw out, my kids took courses there and just one artistic, so one not so much, and just loved every minute.
Malcolm Rogers.
Malcolm, thanks.
Thank you so much for being here. Malcolm Rogers is the longest serving director of the MFA. This week marks his 20th anniversary. To learn more about Malcolm Rogers Day and all the events the museum has organized for this Sunday, go to mfa.org/Mr. 20.
By the way, do you know how long this interview was?
No.
20 minutes.
Great.
Coincidental, but that's exactly
what we're entering into the spirit of things.
Up next, after summer hiatus, Emily Rooney is back for open mic in her list of obsessions and observations. That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
Years in the dark.
He was told, if you just admit to what you're doing, you'll get to go home. When Mr. McCullum signed the statement, he got up to walk out of the room. Law enforcement officer said, where are you going?
Two young brothers condemned for murder in 1983 and then set free this week. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Support for WGBH comes from you and New Repertory Theater, presenting Closer Than Ever, Maltby and Shire's heartwarming musical exploration of love, happiness, and one's struggle for self-definition in the middle years, September 6th to 28th. Tickets at newrep.org.
If you've noticed some difficulty receiving WGBH radio lately, it's not your radio. It's because we're operating at reduced power while we replace our antenna. Thanks for bearing with us until we can be back at full power, stronger than ever.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Here with us in Studio 3 for Open Mug, after a summer hiatus that has been torturous, for us at least, is Emily Rooney, the Emily behind the famous list. Emily, we have really missed you.
I know. It's been, I think, 4 or 5 weeks.
It has.
I took most of the summer off.
It's like a day without sunshine, that kind of thing.
That you took most of the summer off, believe me. So we're starting with politics here?
We are.
Sure.
Is that the deal? So Moore Healey, who was supposedly going to lose to Warren Tolman in the race for Attorney General, she still may, but she's come back bounding just a few days before the election. Women in particular have turned to her. Tolman led among women voters 31 to 28% just last week. Now there's a new poll.
In the Globe,
that's right. Sorry. Says Healey over Tolman 49% to 23%. And many of those people that are in her camp are women.
I mean, I think she's a great candidate. I'm not sure I'm... I mean, do you think it's all about this unbecoming
comment?
I do,
indeed.
From,
I have no independent evidence. This. For those who don't know, at the Boston Globe op-ed thing chaired by Joanna Weiss and Joan Vinaki, when Warren Tolman was being asked questions about what Moore Healey said was his work as a lobbyist with a hedge fund, both of which he denies, and at this online gambling thing, he said, not only is there no merit to this, but this is unbecoming. In the debate itself, no one blinked an eye, and it became
it
this huge issue. And what else has happened that has caused women to abandon him, if these numbers are right?
I'm not sure.
Stunning numbers.
I think they've seen her.
She's a good candidate. She's very knowledgeable. She's very Martha Coakley-esque in a lot of ways.
I think so? She is. Yeah. I think she's just the opposite.
You do?
Yeah. I think that she, I mean, I like Warren Tolman. I've known him for years. She has trounced him in a lot of these debates. And if you watch these debates, including the one you had on your show, Jim, she's really quick. And I think if you were scoring these like a like a prize fight, you'd say, you know, she's won. And,
see, I don't think you see that kind of, assuming the poll numbers are accurate. And again, last week overall, it was 30-30. Now she's got a 16-point lead, not to mention, at least as of today, this huge lead amongst women. Something had to trigger this. And maybe it's the unbecoming word that did what I really wanted to mention here. Is identity politics. I mean, you remember everybody saying, what is it, 96% of African Americans voted for Barack Obama. Maybe it's hard to believe that at least a significant chunk of that wasn't because we finally have an African American who's you don't think part
don't
of this
if,
is.
I don't know if I believe in gender politics, although I was asking somebody in our studio last night after Greater Boston, because we had been discussing that race, and she said, yeah, she's going for the women. And I thought, really? Because I don't have that kind of thing in me that is just, I mean, I've always liked Martha Coakley. That's not the point.
Yeah.
But I can't see just voting for somebody.
So how do you explain the explosion? I mean, it really is.
I think she's also extremely direct. Yeah. I mean, she has criticized her boss, Martha Coakley, on any number of things, including partners, the deal partners with taking over these three hospitals that Martha Coakley said was okay and Healy has differentiated. And she answers questions. A lot of politicians, particularly in debates, they do not answer questions. So
but
far,
you're acting as if she's running against a dead body. Warren is smart.
He is
accomplished.
Smart.
He's a
charismatic.
Progressive. And by the way, he is.
He's a great
and
guy.
And incidentally, other than that comment, Shannon O'Brien, when she called in the next day, who's a supporter who obviously was the first recipient of the unbecoming comment from Romney and said it was a non-issue. What Shannon's explanation to us was, when we said, what's the difference? The difference is, I'm again quoting her, I'm not saying it's true or not true, is Mitt Romney was not a supporter of women. Warren Tolman is. Yeah. That's why it's got to be put in context. So you have to say to yourself.
Could he used another word that would have worked, Jim? Unseemly.
Unseemly. I think, by the way, even I hadn't said this before, but since you asked the question, I just thought of it. Had unbecoming not had a Massachusetts history, if he had used it, it would have been fine.
Yeah.
But because it was such a big issue, even though it wasn't determinative in the Shannon O'Brien Mitt Romney race in 2002, it allowed people to go back to history. Yeah. And the other significant thing about it, and I mentioned this
it
in the debate the other night.
Overtone.
It does.
Unlike unseemly.
But do you notice what was Maura Healey's reaction to it during the debate?
Nothing.
None.
Nothing.
She didn't even, it was
Flinch.
Only after no, that every her supporters decided to pick up on this thing. But I don't know
what
else.
She was probably still in high school when Mitt Romney called Shannon O'Brien unbecoming. That maybe why she didn't even know about it.
See, let me say one last thing on the identity politics deal. Is Massachusetts has such a horrible record, maybe the worst in this country, of electing women to statewide office in Congress, that I think that issue is more relevant here and finally is coming to the fore than would be in other states because of our history.
I'm not convinced she's going to win.
Oh,
well,
she
I don't
may
know if
not
she's
win.
Win.
I mean,
either.
Like you said, I would never call Warren Tolman a dead body. He's a terrific politician.
He's
got a great record. He's a very impressive guy. I just think that this woman has been an extraordinarily good candidate.
It's been such a dead summer, and no one's paying attention.
Yeah.
Finally, people know who. You saw that other poll that showed that in that race, people actually know who's running. They had no idea who's running for treasurer or lieutenant governor or any of that stuff.
In any case, can
maybe
we talk
it's
about
basketball
another woman?
Thing. Maybe it's because she could spin that basketball on her finger. Maybe that was the
it's
thing
in her ad.
Top.
You know, when I had her on my show months ago, I just threw her the basketball. She didn't know it's because I couldn't believe.
Really?
I threw her the ball in the middle of the interview. She puts it on her finger and just starts
spinning.
I love it. Yeah, but you know what he did?
Yeah. What?
He had his sunglasses in his pocket and he put them on at the end of the interview without prompting. You ever seen the spot he did when he ran for governor, lieutenant governor? I'm a tall man. Exactly. In any case, let's talk about another woman who died. Did you know Joan Rivers?
You know, I did not. I don't think I ever had an encounter.
What'd you think of her?
I was a huge fan.
So was I.
I mean, she made me cringe. And a lot of the stuff she said was, you know, bizarre. And I just recently watched that clip on CNN where she got up and huffed off the set because some woman was asking her really dumb questions. And, you know, I was sympathized with her.
We have a little sound, I think, from her, from the documentary that was done on Joan Rivers' life. I want to introduce
it's called Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. And in this thing, actually,
I saw that documentary.
Takes down a heckler to show who objected to a joke she made about deaf people. Here it is.
Let me tell you what comedy is about.
Go ahead and tell me.
Oh, please. You are so stupid. Comedy is to make everybody laugh at everything and deal with things, you idiot. My mother is deaf, you stupid son of a bitch.
Oh, God.
Don't tell me. And just in case you can hear me in the hallway, I lived for 9 years with a man with one leg. Okay, you. And we're going to talk about what it's like to have a man with one leg who lost it in World War II and then went back to get it, because that's littering.
Now, who in the studio can you imagine doing that to an audience if she or he was heckled? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, in this great, great, great obituary in the New York Times today.
Great. Really funny.
Some of the great quotes, let me just read one or two. On Nancy Reagan's hairdo, she says, bulletproof. If they ever combed it, they'd find Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah.
On Queen Elizabeth II, gowns by Helen Keller.
Oh,
I mean,
awful.
She was.
How about the one I read you this morning about
the 9/11?
You want to say that one?
Yeah, that was bad.
Okay, go ahead.
Something about she was called somebody for lunch.
Right after 9/11.
Would you like to meet me at Windows on the Ground?
Yeah. Exactly. Windows in the World was the name of the restaurant at the top.
She had the one about referencing all the plastic surgery she's had. She said something like, I've had so much plastic surgery, when I die, I'm going to donate my body to Tupperware.
That's pretty good. But she is, I mean, beyond being a brilliant comedian, she was the trailblazer, was she not? I mean, she was doing stand-up and doing almost Lenny Bruce-esque, I mean, cutting-edge kind of stand-up. Was any woman doing this before her?
Nothing like this.
Phyllis Diller, the only one I could
think
of.
Not really like that, though.
Yeah, no.
Not
she
with
got,
that kind
she
of
got
acerbic.
Kind of nasty yeah, in her older years. She started really going after people in a way that was unbecoming.
Yeah.
But, you know,
I was a huge fan, though. You know, and I mean, I remember following her career so, you know, definitively. Well, when she first started on Johnny Carson, and then when she was the guest host, I loved it when she was the guest host. And then when her husband died, you know, he committed suicide right after that failed talk show on Fox.
That's right. And here's what she said about this. After Edgar's her husband. Yep. After Edgar killed himself, I went out to dinner with Melissa. I looked at the menu and said, if Daddy were here to see these prices, he'd kill himself all over again.
I know.
Not many of us make jokes about our husband's suicide.
Yeah, she did for years.
Yeah, she did. Yeah.
You know, the one factoid that I was totally unaware of, because I thought I knew actually a decent amount about her, early in her career, she wrote for Candid Camera.
Oh, that was my least favorite television show ever in
and
the world.
Maybe one of my three favorite television shows. People know what everybody knows what Candid Camera is.
Alan Funt.
Exactly.
I don't know. I don't like the kind of humor where you're making fun of someone who you're tricking into doing something, like putting the wallet on a string and then pulling it when somebody goes to. I mean, that's the kind of thing.
Emily,
it was.
If you don't appreciate the talking mailbox, there's something wrong with you.
No.
I'll tell you.
The talking mailbox was great.
Remember that?
Or the one where they all get in the elevator, like six people get in the elevator, and five of them are in on the joke, and one isn't. And all five of them get in the elevator and they turn and face away from the door.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So the sixth person is looking around, thinking everybody's facing away from the door, and he turns around and he faces the door. They do things like all these elevator tricks, people put their hats on and off. I mean, it's a riot. Yeah. You didn't like
okay,
it.
Didn't quite
it's not
it.
My kind of humor.
Okay, let's all move right. to another political thing. Corruption in politics. A guy who apparently was on the short list for the vice presidency for Mitt Romney was convicted of crimes along with his wife. What was it? What's his name, Margaret?
It's McDonald's.
His name is Governor Vaginal Probe McDonald.
That's
okay. You're going to have to explain that one, Marjorie.
He became famous in 2012, or infamous in many circles, because he wanted to pass legislation. He attempted to pass legislation. The bill was altered in Virginia, forcing women who are having abortions to get a vaginal probe before they had that abortion.
Does that even exist, by the way? What is he talking about? Well, He's talking about a sonogram?
Internal sonogram, let's put it that way, with a probe. I mean, it was disgusting and it was horrible, and he backed down. The legislation was passed without him. But for a while, that was his name on the talk shows.
I mean, I guess I'm looking at this from a bigger scenario. It seems like this is the latest one. This has got a tremendous amount of attention because there was a sex scandal involved. Well, his wife had a crush on this businessman that was lavishing them with all these Armani clothes and furs and you name it. But it seems to be like this public corruption thing has just gone amok. I mean, John Rowland, former governor of Connecticut, is going through his second corruption trial. I mean,
He
already went to jail. Are these people dumb, or is this an overreach the way we've seen here in Massachusetts, like going after Tim Cahill? I just don't know. It feels like
no. I'll tell you what it is.
These people are going to get
15 years each, you know. All right, so they took some.
I can't speak to Rowlands. You know, his second set of alleged crimes are after he's already out of office and served time.
For having people build his house.
But the initial act, you know what I think it is? I mean, I don't hate to relate it back to the probation scandal, which the three of us have discussed ad nauseum. There is a sense when you're powerful, among some, luckily not all, that rules just don't apply. When you read what Rowland did, Rowland had this contractor who had business with the state. This is the original charges for which he went to jail. Do work on his vacation house for nothing.
Yeah.
All these gifts and things were plied on McDonald and his wife, in return for which they were promoting whatever product they got.
They gave him access.
I honestly think, this may sound naive, I think the arrogance of power is so intense in some cases that people who do this don't even think they're doing wrong.
No,
I'm not trying to get them off.
John Rowland didn't think the second thing he did was wrong, which was he was going to advise a congressman, somebody running for Congress, but he didn't want to pay him out of his – he said, don't pay me out of your campaign account because people will look askance if you're paying an ex-con, so pay it out of a different account. And so now they're saying he never did it, by the way. The deal never took place, but it was a suggestion that he should do that.
You know what no one has written about, but maybe they've written about it, I haven't seen? Getting back to the guy who was convicted yesterday.
Have you talked about the wife deal here?
No, we're going to say one second, but let's assume he had been picked by Romney.
Yeah.
Let's assume Romney had won the election and the sitting vice president was on trial for these behaviors along with his wife. Would have been a pretty intense moment for the United States.
He would not have – if Romney would have lost by an even greater margin with this guy as the vice president because people would have
been – Because of the vaginal probe.
Absolutely. plus, here's this guy lecturing all these women.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, he's out his whole defense –
bonking around.
His whole defense is that the woman he carried over the threshold when he won the governor's office is yelling at him so much. He called her a harridan and said her screaming at him left him spiritually and mentally exhausted.
That was his defense.
And his defense was that they were so estranged they couldn't have plotted together to do anything. He threw this woman, his wife, no matter how your marriage is, right underneath the bus.
Yeah.
So I mean,
he should go to jail just for that alone.
Can we stay on political wives for a minute?
Right.
You mentioned a minute ago that John Rowland went to jail once and now is having some second problems. What we unearthed this morning is his wife, former First Lady Patty Rowland, during the first trial, because they were upset with the charges, wrote a poem delivered at the Middlesex Chamber of Commerce in Connecticut in 2003, trashing the media. May I read you a selection or two? It's really quite beautiful. I'm late, said Santa. My last stop took hours. All that coal I delivered down the Hartford Current's tall towers. They used to be good girls and boys, Santa said, but the poison pen's power has gone to their head. That's what this is like for maybe 15 minutes. Now, let me ask you as a reporter, is it good practice if you're indicted or about to be indicted and you write a poem trashing the media, what is it likely the media will do in response to that?
I mean, this is the last vestige of a scoundrel and blame the media. I mean, this is – it's so typical and, you know, picking up kind of where – the husband left off and, you know, she carrying the water for him. It's, you know,
and I had the same problem at the media stations. They've just simply forgotten good human relations. Their thirst and their hunger for the day's biggest story has earned them black coal for their ill-gotten glory. It's quite beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, there is a – you know how I feel about this. The media can't wait to run somebody out of town, especially right here in Boston, especially the Boston Globe. They can't wait to take somebody down.
Well, can you name one person who didn't deserve to be taken down who they have, quote, run out of town? Who would that be?
I thought Sal DeMacy was an overreach.
Well, they didn't try him. You think the reporting –
they ran him out of
town.
Wait
a second. You think the reporting on Sal DeMacy by the Globe was over the line? I think it was brilliant and directly on point.
I thought it was gleeful. I thought it was gleeful.
Yeah, but essentially what then? The U.S. attorney could have decided to treat him more kindly. I mean, would there have been a probation scandal?
They were thrilled that story ended the way it did.
That Sal DeMacy?
Yeah.
Well, for whatever it's worth, and I want to go into it, one of the people involved in that is somebody I know fairly well, and that particular person was far from gleeful and actually felt pretty bad. Yeah.
He was a very nice guy. Everybody thought he was great, but he took $60,000.
Yeah.
Okay,
fine. In any case, normally, while we
I guess
miss...
you're going to get to six figures for it to be an indictable offense.
For 8 years anyway.
While we always miss talking about...
That's a different issue.
The issues of the
day.
All
right, let's get going
here. What we really care about is this.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense? Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy. It's your right. Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
I want you to know, even when you're not here, I've played that for myself, just to keep your spirit. Okay, Emily, is it Is there a theme? Is it thematic or is it not?
Yes, and you guys have to play along with
okay,
my theme
we'll do
here
it.
Because the overall arching theme is what?
Okay.
What? All right. Gonna, so you got to okay. So I actually got the idea from listening to your show last month. Because when I heard the governor say that he has never smoked pot, I said, what? I didn't believe
one.
That.
That's
we
a
have
good
the concept.
One.
I still don't believe it. It's like, that's not possible.
Why people would he not say it?
You know, I didn't inhale either. I mean, come on.
Okay.
You know, that's it. So, all right.
How much pot do you smoke, Emily?
A tremendous amount.
Okay.
All through college. That's all you need to know.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, how could you not? Anyway.
How about you, Marjorie?
Once or twice.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
All right. So, here's one that I did not know. And you know what the refrain is going to be here, right? The NFL has nonprofit status.
What? I actually knew that.
I
and Congress
just found
is contemplating
out.
And taking non-profit away last year.
Profit
yes, that's true.
What? Yeah, I was just reading Steve Allman's book this week.
Wait
I
a minute. So the taxes are all different?
Well,
everything?
It's different for every franchise, and of course they do pay taxes. But the NFL itself is a nonprofit organization. All
oh
right.
My God, that's the ultimate jock sniffing story, isn't it?
Would you care to guess? The new Boston police vehicles are Ford Expeditions. Would you like to guess what they get, what the miles per gallon is?
12.
7 miles.
Eight.
Ooh. What?
What? Exactly. I'm sorry. We forgot that. What?
I know. I asked a cop. I said, well, what does it get for mileage? It's got all these bells and whistles and all this. It's 8 miles. It has spent half the time in the gas station.
We have the commissioner
all
coming
right,
in
this
later
is my,
in the month.
This
we'll
is my
up.
Very best one.
There you go.
Are you ready? I can't even believe this. You're both got to do this. The Cambridge Birthing Center offers the husband the opportunity to stand nude during the delivery.
What?
It's true. It's true. Wait I know somebody whose wife is having a baby
a
there,
minute.
And they offer you the opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah, why?
Is her husband taking the opportunity?
He's
going
to take a pass.
Hold on. Why?
What?
Do they get a lot of requests? I mean,
apparently,
what would cause them
well, Jim, you can answer this question.
Yeah,
you're a Cambridgeite.
No, I have
Canterbridgian,
I have stood
me.
Nude at many Sandalista. Cambridge events, not just birth moments. And by the way, I haven't been invited to do it. I've decided that I've...
Oh,
I mean,
my God.
That's it. All right.
That is the winner. You're right.
All right, that's the winner. All right. Okay. All right. So the other day...
What?
This is totally my fault.
Wait a minute. Somebody write a story about this? If not, we have to get on this
why
right
don't
away.
You should get on it.
Absolutely.
How does that fit in your Catholic
yeah,
spirituality
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Beat?
Yeah, that's right. I'm no longer at the Herald.
Okay,
I'd
go ahead.
Be
all right,
able to
so,
do it.
I was just preface by saying that this is partly my fault because I forgot about the no bag rule and I went to one of those Patriots pregame, you know, preseason games. They made me throw my purse in the trash.
Oh.
That is not true.
Yeah.
There's not a place to put it aside and lock it up?
So, I have to empty it and had everything with me, which is so stupid, including my day planner and everything. They made me put everything in plastic bags. And then I put the purse down and I said, well, can I get it when I come back? No. They made me actually throw it in the trash.
Oh.
That's not possible. That's
bag?
Not possible. Well, obviously it was.
It wasn't. It was my one $7 Marshall's
oh, good.
Bag.
Oh,
but
good.
I love that bag. And you know what I did? I picked it up on the way out.
But wait a second.
It's still there.
If you could put all of your other things in a
which
plastic
is
why bag,
it's
why
so
couldn't
stupid.
You do that?
It's so stupid.
Oh, you should call
they
Mr.
made me
Kraft
put all of my, and I had like three bags, you know, Ziploc bags full of crap that it was carrying. It's like, it was stupid.
Do you know there's a section at the Patriots game where men can sit nude during the, do you know that?
All right, one more. Another here. All right.
It's this not
is,
true.
This is,
hey, forget that.
This is a little outrageous,
okay,
but I can't help it.
Okay.
Whenever I hear about a prison escape,
yeah.
I root for the escapees.
What?
There was
and
a guy in China,
that
30
horrible.
Guys
this
who got
horrible.
Out of the Tennessee juvenile.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know.
Well, I can see that. The Shawshank Redemption. Shawshank.
All right,
no, but most of these guys are not good people.
One more. This
okay.
is a GBH
okay.
one.
Okay.
Some
yeah.
of them are wrongly accused.
Go ahead.
One of my colleagues here at WGBH was denied a hall pass because she is a chronic offender, meaning... She chronically loses her pass.
Is that really true?
True?
What?
Yes, it's true.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness. She works for your show.
She does? We're looking at the people who work for our show. It's not you, is it? One of our colleagues has
what?
A blank look
what
on her face.
They're not going to give you a hall pass.
That is outrageous.
You mean the thing that allows
yeah.
you to get in
yeah.
the doors?
Yeah.
So what, she just stay in her room? What else?
She's stuck.
Emily, we have missed you in ways. What
thank
are you doing
you.
Tonight?
Let's see. We're doing, you know, the
no
sensitivity
oh,
of
sorry.
Handling, you know, the beheading video,
oh,
whether you
good.
Should show it at all, whether it shows them for who they are, or, you know, we're just carrying their message for them. And then we're doing a thing about the, you know, the nude photos that hit the internet and whether, you know, some people are, it's in a terrible invasion of privacy and the media shouldn't be. And the other people are saying, what are these people so stupid that they don't know that you can't, that once it's out there,
it's out there? Also, these are people that probably look pretty good.
Not only that, but of course, my personal opinion is probably intentional. But, I'm just...
Shocking. Okay. Emily, it's great to have you back. Emily Rooney, watch her tonight at 7.
7 o'clock tonight, Beat the Press, every night during the week. Emily Rooney on Greater Boston. Up next, this is really exciting. Our news quiz is going to feature two college students who have invented cake in a can. Questions and how you make a cake in a can, all coming up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Chef Brendan Pelly from Zebra's Bistro and Wine Bar.
We're probably going to bring some unique charcuterie to the table. That's one of the things that we do here that's a little different, I would say. Mostly I'm looking forward to hanging out with the other chefs. Boston has a really close-knit food scene. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Check out Brendan's pan-seared scallop recipe when you pick up your tickets to the Taste of WGBH Food and Wine Festival. Online at wgbh.org/festival.
WGBH programs are here thanks to you and the Boston Symphony Orchestra's 2014-15 season, shining a welcoming spotlight on Andras Nelsons as he makes his anticipated debut as BSO Music Director, featuring an eclectic offering of music. Tickets at bso.org. And Celebrity Cruises, sponsor of the GBH Food and Wine Festival. You can discover the world and relax knowing you can do as much or as little as you choose. That's modern luxury. Details at 1-800-CELEBRITY or your travel agent. Ships Registry Malta.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. It is time for our Friday news quiz, the Cake Batter in a Can edition. You heard me right. Here with us in Studio 3 are the masterminds behind this, Harvard students John McCallum and Brooke. Is it Nowakowski? Is that how you say it?
That's Nowakowski.
Pleasure to meet you both, John and Brooke. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
Okay, so please tell people, what is cake in a can, please?
Simply, it's cake batter, delicious, organic, all-natural ingredient cake batter in a whipped cream-style can. You get it, you spray it out for no fuss, no muss baking. You can microwave it, you can draw with it, and that's basically spray cake.
Now, Brooke, the inspiration for this, I read in the Boston Globe, was actually one of our favorite people and one of the great bakers of our time, Joanne Chang from Chang & Myers and Flower Bakery and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. What's that story?
Honestly, John's probably better equipped to tell that story because when he was a freshman, he took a course at which Joanne Chang was one of the lecturers. And
so
she
let's
came
ask
by.
Him. Okay, yeah, so what happened, John?
She just came in. She described the chemistry of how cakes rise, and that was a really important piece of information in terms of determining how spray cake would operate. And so I really appreciate her coming in that class, and the class taught me a lot about cooking that I really didn't know. I wasn't exactly an expert chef coming into the class.
Were you like a science genius or something?
Well, I'm a social studies major, so not exactly.
And when did you enter this, Brooke? What's your deal? I mean, you're a little late to the game,
I
right?
I am a little bit late, but I actually knew John since we started at Harvard. We met during freshman orientation, and he actually happened to bring some spray cake to our dining hall after a week in lab, and he just said, try this cake. He didn't really tell me what it was for or where it had come from, and I just tried it. I said, well, this tastes great, but what's so special about it? And then he told us it had come from a whipped cream can.
So we have in the studio here this silver whipped cream can. Now, I assume what you do is you put, like whipped cream, you just spray that into a little container, and then you cook it in the oven or the microwave.
Yep.
And I think you should have a taste
Well, it'll taste it in a couple of minutes, but when you say it just casually in the oven or microwave, what I've read is you can do a cupcake, in 30 seconds or something?
Seconds.
Is that what the deal is?
Yes.
And a whole cake in how long?
A whole cake in the microwave, it'll take about a minute to a minute and a half, depending on what size microwave or the voltage. But within the oven, it actually takes a little bit less time than a regular cake because it's pre-aerated. It doesn't need time to rise.
Is this thing on the market yet or no?
Not yet, but we're working to get it there as soon as possible, and we really think that we're moving in that direction, so we'll definitely let y'all know when it is.
You know what's unbelievable? A couple of weeks ago, or a month or two ago, we had two Harvard, I think they were students, I don't think they were graduates, who were doing something similar to you. They had come up with this notion of marketing bug food, essentially.
Six foods.
So six foods. Is that so? What's going on? And what's in the water in Harvard? I'm serious. That all of a sudden, Brooke, what's going on here?
Honestly, Harvard is known as a community that has a lot of interesting ideas. But unfortunately, there's sort of this stereotype that we all tend to leave as soon as we get a good idea and we don't come back until it's a success story. And so what we've been doing lately on campus, there have been new opportunities given to students to encourage us to stay in school while pursuing our ventures and our concepts. And Six Foods is a group of graduated students now and a few students currently in. But they're working hard and making a lot of great progress.
Okay, so we will both try it in a couple of minutes, and we'll tell you, they'll tell you what Joanne Chang's review was of their spray cake in a couple of minutes. Want to start, Marjorie?
Okay, ready, Brooke?
Ready.
What's Conan O'Brien talking about here?
A spokesperson for Jennifer Lawrence is calling her a flagrant violation of privacy. That's what she said, yes. Meanwhile, Kim Kardashian is calling her stuff I was going to release next week.
She's like, that's 4 days early. It's not time yet. Someone hacked my to-do list.
Okay, you know what he's talking about there?
That sounds like Celebgate to me.
Which is?
What's Celebgate?
Explain what it is. It is, so, you know what it is, but go, what is Celebgate?
So Celebgate, essentially, there are a number of celebrities who, for whatever reason, had photos linked to the cloud. And there was a hacker who was able to access their photos through iCloud and download them. And they've since been disseminated all over the internet. And it's just mayhem.
I had no idea it was called Celebgate. There you go. You're absolutely right. That was great.
Now, Emily Rooney thinks, as she told us a few minutes ago, they wanted them to be released. But that's for another day. In any case, John, here's your opportunity to catch up. You two are an item now. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So is there a little conflict about this? Okay, we'll just get into it. President Obama traveled to Wales this week for the NATO World Summit. Please take a listen.
President Obama will be at a NATO summit where he will discuss the recent actions of who was not invited. Then said, has that ever stopped me before? Hello, boys. Nice meeting you have here. Was I supposed to wear a shirt?
Okay, who was not invited to the NATO summit, John?
Sounds a little bit like Vladimir Putin.
Sounds exactly like Vladimir Putin, and that is correct. It's 1-1 at the end of one round. Marjorie?
Here is airline industry analyst Stephen Colbert.
This is a trend across all major airlines. As Airline Weekly put it, quote, densification is a major trend in the industry now. And when there's major densification, you can expect a little punchification. Some shouting, and eventually someone's going to get stabulated.
Okay, here's a question. So what has been causing outbursts on air flights recently? Why are passengers coming to blows?
Don't look at John. No, this is you're all on your own here, Brooke.
I really couldn't tell you. Is it the size of passengers and flights?
Well, I don't think that's good enough, judges, is it? No, it's not.
Not quite. Do you know, John?
Want to steal the question?
I mean, it's been really hot recently, so that would do it for me.
How tall are you?
I'm about 6 feet tall.
How tall are you? You're tall.
I'm 6 foot myself.
You're 6 foot. Well, you both should know the answer. What's the answer, Marjorie?
The answer is those knee defenders that people put on their trays so that you cannot recline in the seats. And people have been coming to blows about it. Now, this would have been a great invention for you guys. The knee defenders, right?
Yeah, the guy invented them, and all of a sudden his site has crashed. They sell for like $26. It doesn't allow the seat to recline, It's caused some conflict.
Yeah, that's right.
I have already bought a couple of pairs. I have, and I'm waiting. I'm 6'5", and it's a problem when the little kid who's 4'2" in front of you reclines his seat fully because he's a little brat.
Definitely now, feel your pain.
Thank you. Here is, John, you can take the lead here. Here's Conan O'Brien weighing in on a major act of inclusivity.
Big victory for the gay community. I don't know if you heard the news, but for the first time ever, a gay group will be allowed to Yeah. So if you're at next year's and you see two Irishmen rolling around on the ground, it might not be a fight.
Okay, John, what will the gay community be able to do next year that it hasn't been able to do in the past?
Two Irishmen rolling around, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Will they be able to do some sort of will they be in the St. Patrick's Day parade?
That is one of the best guesses in the history of the quiz, and it is correct. March in the New York City St. Patrick's Day parade. So what's the score at the end of two rounds? It's 2-1, John, correct? Is that right? Yeah, it is. Okay, can we taste this baby
to take
here?
The case.
Okay, you take the first bite. Now, describe what it is. What does this thing look like, and what are you doing exactly, Marjorie? What is it? It's a cupcake, right?
It looks like a cupcake.
Is it a cupcake, John?
It's in a very cute.
Yes,
little...
sir. It's basically a cupcake, just in a little ramekin.
Oh, it was just cooked because the container is still warm.
Now, wait a second. Before you do this, here's the problem. If you think it tastes good, that's great. If you think it tastes bad, what are you going to do with the two inventors here?
I won't tell them.
Okay, no. I think you have to tell the truth. Go ahead. You go first.
We appreciate your honesty.
Okay, Marjorie's eating it. Marjorie's eating the... Oh, she has a
nice look on her face. Okay.
Now,
okay.
Does it taste like a cake or a cupcake?
It absolutely tastes like a cupcake.
Okay, you talk for a second. I want to try. Go ahead. Describe what the taste is like.
Well, what do you do about frosting? Do you like frost over the top if you want to frost over the top?
Yeah, you're going to want to frost it after it cools down a little bit like any other cake. Otherwise, it's going to slip and slide all over the place. But yeah, you can pipe frosting or you can just put a little whipped cream or ice cream on top. We like our cake a la mode. So honestly, whatever your personal preference is, we've seen it all.
By the way, it is fabulious.
The point is, this is a lot easier and faster and you don't have to hassle with all the cleaning and the cooking and everything else.
No, it's a lot easier, and it's just good ingredients, honestly. It's a big priority for us to maintain an organic standard, all-natural ingredients, and just make sure that this is a good-tasting, healthy cake.
So the thing will be, when you guys get to market, you'll just go and buy the spray can at a supermarket. Is that right, John? And then
yes.
You just take it home, you spray it into the ramekin or whatever it is, if it's cake, into a cake dish. You put it in the microwave for a minute, and you have a cake or a cupcake? Is that how it's going to work?
That's exactly the idea. You can also use a coffee mug, something that more people might have on hand than a ramekin. And this way you get nice, fresh, baked-from-scratch tasting cake every time. Because ordinarily, if you bake a dozen or a couple dozen cupcakes, they get room temperature and they're still okay.
Yeah.
But it's just so good when they first come out of the oven and you can get that experience every time this way.
I asked you before if you're a science genius, and you said no. So how did you even – I mean, I understand the concept, but how did you go from concept to – reality. Did you consult people who do have a scientific background? What'd you do?
It was just a really great class, and there was a lot of trial and error, a lot of motivation for trial and error too, because this is a great business to have to eat your mistakes in. And so, it was easy to keep on coming back to the drawing board.
And would you have been interested in him at all, Brooke, were it not for the spray cake? Tell the truth.
Well, I'm lucky. We were actually dating before spray cake had begun.
But that's a nice story. But is it true?
he's a smart guy, and I'm lucky to be with him. But I feel very fortunate to be in the venture as well.
That's pretty great.
Okay, here's your next question, Brooke. Ready?
I'm ready.
Here's some sports news, courtesy of The Tonight Show.
Some big sports news. It was just reported that the... signed the openly gay football player Michael Sam to their practice squad. That's right. People are happy Sam gets to be a especially the Indian, the cop, and the construction worker.
Okay. Here's the question. Who signed Michael Sam?
Oh, my gosh. I am glad he got signed, but I really don't know who signed him.
Okay. You want to take a guess there, John?
I feel a little bad. I'm still in such depression over the Packers losing last night to her Seattle Seahawks that I've got to think about all the other teams that are out there.
Are you
now.
From Wisconsin and Washington State, you two?
Washington State and Louisiana. John's a Saints fan.
Oh, you're a Saints fan.
Saints fan, too. But, see, my dad grew up when they had about three channels on TV, and so the Packers were always on.
Oh, got it. Oh, I just noticed the accent. So, do you know what the answer, what team it is?
I don't write off. I'll guess the... Carolina Panthers.
That would be wrong. Who is it, Marjorie?
It's the Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah.
Before we go back to the quiz, you guys said before, I think you said it, Brooke, that Harvard now is helping people, entrepreneurs, have an opportunity to develop some of their...
So what does
that mean? That you take fewer classes or they let you graduate in 5 years or what?
Well, for us right now, we're enrolled in a class at the engineering school that is literally called Startup Research and Development. And it's a course that allows a bunch of young student undergrads, all interested in their own ventures from all kinds of backgrounds and sectors, to talk about their ideas and develop them in tandem. And on top of that, we've got access to the Harvard Business School iLab, which is a fantastic resource on campus. We have all kinds of speakers come through. It's literally the innovation space.
So can you do this through your whole 4 years, or is it just this one-shot deal? You take it 1 year and that's it?
We're able to repeat the Startup R&D course, which does encourage students like us, because we started our business when we were both 19 and sophomores. We're juniors now, but we have no intentions of leaving before we graduate. So I was learning how
to boil water at 19. Now, John, one last question before we ask you your question. One of the things I love to do is to spray whipped cream. I know this is disgusting. Directly from the can into my mouth. Of course, I only did that when I was youth. What happens if you spray this thing? You don't do the microwave, don't do the oven thing. You just spray it right in. What do you get there? Have you ever done that? Tell the truth.
Well, we can't necessarily officially endorse doing such
a thing.
However, some people do find cake batter to be very, very good.
That's very exciting.
And our cake batter is also very, very good.
I bet it is. Okay,
so
here's your question.
If you want to do the spoon thing with the cake batter, you can do that too if you just don't want to wait till it cooks. That is one of the fun things about cooking a cake in a normal way, right?
That's the
truth. Put the cake in the can and you have all the leftover, not in the can, in the pan, and you have all the leftover batter, which is so good.
Okay, John, here's your question.
You ruined my whole line. Brooke was going to say something.
Oh, we were? I'm sorry. What were you going to say?
I was going to say Jimmy Fallon actually demoed just such a thing the other day.
He did? What did he do?
Yeah, he was mentioning spray cake in his opening monologue and kind of sprayed some right into his mouth, so it can be done.
Okay, we're going to the bonus round, judges. We are. Okay, here's the deal. Since you're famous by way of putting cake in a can, we're going to ask you about Yes, We Can, the slogan that was popularized by Barack Obama's 2008 presidential campaign, but there's so much more to those famous words. So your first question this round,
Marjorie, is
for John.
I always preface this by saying, John, everybody gets these wrong, so don't worry about it. There have been a lot of variations on Yes, We Can. Which of the following is a real one? This is multiple choice. A, Yes, We Bran. That was a headline in the Vineyard Gazette about Michelle Obama, who was spotted buying Raisin Bran muffins at a bakery in Edgartown. Or B, Yes, We Tan. That was an NBC headline referencing the president's beige suit, which he wore for his press conference on ISIS in Syria. Or C, Yes, We Can's Ass. That was the Leavenworth Times headline the day after Obama won the presidential election. Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, is where President Obama's mother grew up.
Wow.
Yes, We Brown, Yes, We Tan, or Yes, We Can's Ass. What's the answer?
I guess I got to go with the topical Yes, We Tan. So B.
Very good. This is why they get into Harvard. They make these great guests on. He didn't have no idea about the other thing, and he guessed that right. And now he's guessing this right.
I invented spray cake years ago, Marjorie. I just chose not to market it. Okay, Brooke, here's your opportunity. Yes, We Can is a song. In fact, there are at least five songs titled Yes, We Can. Mm-hmm. We're going to play you a clip of one of these songs and ask you who's singing it. Oh. Judges, I believe the first one is That's The and Made in Mexico. Is that the answer to that? Okay, sorry. The first one is the band Made in Mexico. They recorded this for Guitar Hero 2. B is the Christian rock band Me in Motion. And C is Oscar Zia, Sweden's answer apparently to Justin Bieber. Is it A, B, or C, Brooke, who recorded that fabulous song there?
Wow, I didn't even know there was another Justin Bieber elsewhere in the world.
I know. It's appalling.
A, B, or C?
I would say B.
That is exactly correct. Now, what is the score, judges, with one question to go? Can you tell me, please? John, you're ahead by one. Here's the deal. You get this right, you win. You get this wrong, you lose. That's the way it works here on this show. So here's the final question. Take it away, Marjorie.
Okay. Yes, We Can is the name of a TV show out of Singapore. Which of these is the true description of the show? A, it's a comedy about the workers at a waste removal company. B, it's an education show with a focus on youth empowerment. Or C, it's a drama about young entrepreneurs looking for love and money.
Wow. Man, I should have spent more time talking to my friend RJ about Singaporean TV.
It's a little late now. Go ahead. A, B, or C?
Lifeline to RJ.
I've got to go with A because I want that to be a thing, I think. I like the pun.
That
no,
would be wrong.
That is wrong. Do you want to take a shot?
Would it be B?
Is wrong.
Try C.
Oh, really?
Wow. Okay, fine.
It's a drama about young entrepreneurs in search of love and money.
You're
kidding
me.
You guys, there you go.
Okay, let's call it a tie. Now, before we go, the suspense has been killing all of us. The finest bakery person anywhere is, of course, Joanne Chang. Tell us what her review was of the cake.
You know, Joanne was able to try out our cake, and we were just so lucky to have her. She honestly gave us some great feedback. She tried both flavors, vanilla and chocolate, in combination with each other. We call that our tiger stripe cake.
Mm-hmm.
And she really seemed to enjoy it, which made us feel really good. She does feel like a little salt wouldn't hurt, but honestly, I respect her opinion. I think
before we only have 30 seconds, were you not in total frenzy and panic? You have Joanne Chang testing this thing, John. What was it like waiting for the verdict?
Trying to put on a brave front because, I mean, all of a sudden this, you know, expert was trying my little cake and just, I was kind of scared to death, frankly.
And it all worked out.
It did. It was very fortunate.
Well, congratulations, you two. This is really unbelievable.
Yeah, good luck. It was a great idea, and I hope you had great success with this. It was really good.
Thank you.
And I think that I could, you know, have an even bigger serving of that than I got to. Next time you come, bring about six of them. That'd be good.
What business had you started by 19 when you were at Stanford, Margaret?
Are you kidding?
Exactly. Thank you very much.
Okay. John McCallum and Brooke Nowakowski are the Harvard students behind Spraycake. To learn more about it and them, go to facebook.com/officialspraycake. John and Brooke, thank you so much for being here both days. It was a lot of fun. You did great in the quiz.
Thanks for having us.
You all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in Monday for our pre-primary coverage on Election Eve with WGBH analyst David Bernstein and the Boston Globe's Jim O'Sullivan. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team is Chelsea Mers, Will Rosup, Amanda McGowan, and our engineer is Alan Mattis. I am Marjorie Egan, and you've got a big event tonight.
Oh, that's right. The final debate of three I'm moderating this week, NECN at 6 o'clock, simulcast on GBH Radio. The Republicans running for governor, Charlie Baker and Mark Fisher at 6 o'clock. Thanks for mentioning it.
You've been a debate marathoner all week long, Jim.
You've done
a great job. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks for listening, and please tune in again on Monday. Have a great weekend.